hit it. You gotta zap it and make it go red.
Call the Board of Forestry and Fire Protection to order. And while I do that, I'd like to introduce board members. On my left, Member Gary Reinierson. And I can't see down that far, but I think Member Pam Giacomini, Member Ron Nehring. I'm Stan Dixon, the chair. To my right, Member Kirk Markwald, Member David Nowy, Member Mark Bassetti, Member Jim Ostrowski, and Member Bruce Sito. And with that, I would turn it over to Vice Chairman Bob Hatoy of the Fish and Game Commission.
Thank you. And welcome to the joint meeting of the Board of Forestry and the California Fish and Game Commission. I'm Bob Hatoy, the Vice President of the Fish and Game Commission. Our President, Michael Flores, is somewhere en route. So at this point, I get to be in charge, if there's such a thing. First, I'd like to introduce who's in the room. Our Natural Resources Secretary for the State of California, Mike Chrisman. I think we should acknowledge him. It's all about rank. Next, we'll start with the commissioners that are here. There's none on my right. So on the far left, not reflecting our political views, our newest commissioner who lives in Tahoe City, and that's why we're all here, Cindy Gustafson. Next, we have Commissioner from Carpinteria, California, Ron Rogers. We have our new executive director, Richard Rogers. Jesus. You know, I'm into Broadway show tunes. There's a whole other thing that goes on there. No, that's Richard Rogers, too. Anyway.
It's okay, Frank.
I can't see all the way down there. Okay, I think the next person we have is our new executive director, John Carlson. Then there's me. Then there's no one here. Also, our staff, we have assistant executive director, John Fisher. And then we have our, I call her the special agent, but I think she's the chief of stuff, Adriana Shea. We also have Sherry Cole. And also protecting us and watching over us is Warden Danny Moraga and the chief of wardens, Nancy Foley. And so that's my introductions. I've also been asked to call upon Ron Trebass, who represents the North Lake Tahoe Resort Association. He's sort of our host today, and he'd like to stand up and say a few words of welcome.
I felt like I did real well compared to the introduction of the other people. We do want to welcome all of you. This is a real honor to have a joint meeting like this between two real positive boards and the board and commission. I did want to tell you, in case you lost sight of it, that you are at Lake Tahoe, and if you could see out the windows behind you, you would be looking down a beautiful lake. My name, as Bob said, is Ron Trebass, and I am with the North Lake Tahoe Resort Association. Normally the mayor comes out and does this, but since we're unincorporated and don't have a mayor, there are a select group of us that are always eager to make sure that people know that they're welcome here. One of those that probably would be doing this is better than I would be doing it, unfortunately, sitting at the table up there and wouldn't be able to get down off that thing. But anyway, I am with the North Lake Tahoe Resort Association. I'm a director of community partnerships and planning for the North Lake Tahoe area. I'm also one of the very few elected officials that we do have up here, and being the president of the Tahoe City Board of Directors of the Tahoe City Public Utility District. And my third thing that I do on Tuesdays is I'm president of the Sierra State Parks Foundation. On Wednesdays, well, maybe tomorrow we'll talk about what I do on Wednesdays. But as I said, you're sitting on the edge of a great big blue pond that's right out behind you that's, as you probably know, 22 miles long, 12 miles across, 72 miles if you went around the edge. This thing has a maximum depth of about 1,685 feet and an average depth of, I think it's 989 feet. It sometimes in the summer gets up to maximum temperature of 68 degrees and never on the surface gets below 41 degrees, so it's always very swimmable. If we could somehow tip it a little bit, and pour it into the Panama Canal. In fact, if the Panama Canal, which is 70 feet wide, 50 feet deep, ran all the way around the globe at the equator, we'd fill up that Panama Canal, and we could do another Panama Canal from San Francisco to New York City. And then it would start to dry up. Same thing if we took the puppy and tipped it upside down. We'd put about 14 and a half inches of water over the whole state of California. Boy, I could see Southern California starting to light up right now with that thought. And then we could even do Texas at 8.5 inches deep. So it's a pretty big, beautiful, pristine body of water that is the main reason why a lot of us are here. Why are we here? We aren't incorporated. We certainly don't have cheap houses. Cost of living is pretty low. It is not very low. Our school system, which is a good one, is not world class. There's just not, and not very many of us have ever been transferred in here in our jobs. The reason we're really here has a common thread, and that's the natural resource. We're here because of wanting to be in the outdoors. And with that, we realize there's a responsibility for environmental stewardship. The area here needs to have clean and clear water, great open spaces, scenic beauty, abundance of plant and wildlife, and a great opportunity for recreational endeavors. And it is these elements that encourage people to live here and for worldwide visitors to come to Lake Tahoe. With that in mind, we also then realize that we need to maintain and enhance all of these qualities and assure access to them all, so that it's a real important factor in our economic and environmental health and well-being. While we're not incorporated here and we don't get to make a lot of our own decisions, between our citizenry and our special districts, we work very closely with and advise the some 73-plus national, state, and county agencies and organizations that do make those decisions. We might not have the abalone concerns or the Morro Bay issues, but we do have some of our own, from as simple as the bears and the need to inform people of how to properly respect and participate with the bears, to the extreme wildfire situation that we have here, and the need to continue to secure state fire assistance funds in order to help clean up some of that potential. There's also the need, of course, for water clarity, improved fish habitat, amongst other issues. We're in the middle now of doing a plan for the next 20 years of the Lake Tahoe Basin. Our first 20-year plan is just coming to its end, and now we're setting the future and a total basin-wide planning effort for developing what will happen in the Lake Tahoe Basin area over the next 20 years. It's really an exciting time and an exciting place to live, and we're very excited that you're all here for these meetings this week, and you have the opportunity to see what some of our specialness is and some of what our needs are. We know that you'll just have a grand time, and we welcome you to Lake Tahoe. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your hospitality. And as a matter of fact, last year the Board of Forestry did have their meeting here in this building, but the room configuration was a little different. They had the board looking out the window with the blinds up, and it was a disaster. It was for obvious reasons that you detailed. I neglected to introduce board staff at the time I introduced the members. We have our executive officer next to me, George Gentry, Eric Huff, George, Chris Zimney, Carol Horn, and Laura Estrada with us today. Representing the department, Bill Snyder, Duane Shintako, Dennis Hall, some others. Chris is here. Chris Browder.
He has arrived.
I'm our new deputy. Chief deputy.
Okay. Wayne Mitchell. I have just a couple of very brief remarks.
I have no remarks.
About today. There are on today's agenda several significant joint policies that I believe both the board and the commission should be able to adopt either today at this joint meeting or independently, since both bodies are meeting here in this building for the next couple of days, that all of these policies should become adopted before we leave to go back to Sacramento. And I've forgotten the other issue that I had. Well, we're going to ad-lib this process this morning, since it is a joint meeting, and I would ask Bob if he has any remarks before we get to the agenda itself.
No remarks, except I, too, overlooked a couple of our important staff people. Just entering is our new Chief Deputy Director, John McCammon, and right there. And we have two of our Deputy Directors, Sankey Mastrip and Banky Curtis, over there. They keep us informed and marching in the right direction, so I didn't want to overlook them. And as far as remarks, I have none now, but I'm sure I will later. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We'll start with the agenda then, and probably the most important thing on this morning's agenda is the appearance of the Secretary of Resources, Mike Chrisman. We're honored and privileged to have Mike with us this morning. Mike?
Thank you, Stan. Thank you, members of the Board of Forestry and Commission, and everybody in the audience. First of all, let me say it's nice to see that these meetings are continuing. I think most of you know I had the privilege of serving for 7 years on the State Fish and Game Commission, and during those years, these joint meetings were an important part of what we did. Richard and I were talking last night. I think the first of these regular meetings, the joint meetings that I went to, was in Sacramento as a commissioner, and Richard was actually on the State Board of Forestry at the time. And so, fortunately, these activities have continued. I think it's really important that we work closely together, and our staffs work very, very closely together. These issues that we jointly work on, the commission works on, the State Board of Forestry, and together with the departments, are critical to us achieving our mission. Let me talk a little bit about, and I want to be very informal about this, and I hope there'll be some questions maybe when I'm done, but I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the work that we've been doing, some of the priorities that we have, and then obviously ask for your help. You've all been very good over the years of offering advice, suggestions, help, pushing us when we needed to be pushed, to helping us focus on directions that we needed to focus on. And so I think as you think about it, you think about the work that we've been doing, particularly on the timber side, on the forestry side. We came in December of 2003. We immediately got involved in the work with our federal partners, Forest Service, on Sierra Nevada framework, and kind of working to reconfigure that process. We are still engaged in that effort, the framework effort, and effort on roadless policy here in California. Big issues. Many of you have worked with us on that. We're making significant strides in that area. We've just got Crawford Tuttle, who was our Deputy Secretary of External Affairs at the agency, has just moved to the Department of Forestry and Fire Protection to become Chief Deputy to help in those activities of kind of beginning to focus from a policy perspective on many of the forestry initiatives that you've all been very helpful to us in achieving. Other issues, obviously the coho listing. The coho listing is one that we worked on. I worked on the years I was on the commission. The listing, of course, is in place. Of course, the lawsuit is in place. Also, as you would expect in something like this, we will get through this. We will get through this and begin to, I'm convinced, be able to work in such a way that we not only protect the landowners, protect the operations in place, but also begin to recover those species. Klamath is one of the first trips that I made as secretary when I became secretary was was a loaded up an airplane and flew up to Klamath Falls, because very fresh in our memories, Ben, in the fall of 2003 was the fish die-off that occurred a couple years before that along the Klamath. And the need to recognize the need to do a better job of the joint operations of that effort, of that whole river system, and to try to avoid those die-offs again. And we've so far been successful at it. It's been nip and tuck certain years, given last year, given the water conditions on the Klamath. The conversation we've been having this year with the Pacific Fisheries Management Council on the salmon stocks teaches us again of the whole process of managing salmon. The fact that we manage them for the stream that's in the greatest stress, of course, that being the Klamath, goes to the issue that we've been also working on since day one. As we look at the Klamath, you've got the FERC relicensing processes in place right now. We've been very engaged in bringing the parties together. Again, many of you in this room have been helpful in that process. That continues to go, we think, very well. Good conversations with the folks at the landowners, the agriculturalists, the tribes, conservationists, and timber interests, and local government, state government, federal government. Our efforts are working well. Hopefully, over the next few months, we'll see some light there and begin to see some real changes on that system. Again, we all know the challenges on the Klamath system, and again the FERC process, that we're the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission relicensing process that we're going through right now, kind of highlights all of that. So, again, big issues. Other big issues that many of you, of course, in this room, also been involved with is a very successful effort to creating the Sierra Nevada Conservancy here in California. 22 counties across 25 million acres, largest conservancy in the nation. We are in the process now. We've hired an executive officer. We've got the board in place. We've got an interim headquarters in Auburn set up. We're going through our strategic planning process. We're having public workshops. One was down over in Jackson just last week. Another one down in Exeter. Another one up in Nevada City next week. So again, the strategic planning process is begin to lay out kind of the blueprint for how the Sierra Nevada Conservancy will operate over the next multiple lifetimes is critically important. I would really encourage those of you that live in the areas that on our website we have these workshops, get yourself engaged in them. Come to these workshops, take a look at the strategic plan, make some suggestions on how you think this Sierra Nevada Conservancy can best operate, because it is a very, very different conservancy. It is about resource protection, resource conservation, landscape protection, but it's also about economic and job growth. It's marrying the two issues. And again, if you look at the board of directors, the 13 members, six of whom are locally elected officials across the subregions, guarantee there will be a very strong local government impact and input on the efforts that we have in the conservancy. So, again, I encourage you all to be involved. This is a big effort, and I can't be in Lake Tahoe without talking about if the blinds were open, which I wish they were. If the blinds were open and we could see this magnificent lake, it would remind us of the work that the Tahoe Conservancy, TRPA, the folks who live and work in this part of the world, have the work that they've done to protect this magnificent gem that people come from all over the world to see. Tahoe Conservancy has a new executive officer, Patrick Wright, just took over a few months ago. Dennis Machida, many of you, of course, knew Dennis well. Dennis was there at the Conservancy from the beginning. Somebody who was, for me, a mentor and over the years, somebody who helped me a lot as we dealt with these very, very complex natural resources issues. But Patrick and the board will carry his legacy and the legacy of the folks here in Tahoe very well. And it's, again, reminds us of the on the ground, locally directed, but with support from the state, and in this case Nevada, to protect this magnificent resource. So again, let me say that's just across the top of the issues we're dealing with. Let me thank you all as leaders of both the Board of Forestry and the Commission for maintaining these joint meetings. These are really important efforts. The work that we do in the resources agency is about partnerships. It's about partnerships not only with the boards and commissions that we have in the agency, but communities and folks that we work with over the years. So, again, thanks. And thanks for the invitation to be here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mike, did you indicate that you might take some questions if
sure.
there were
be
some?
Happy to.
Commissioners or board members have
one person I want to introduce questions? Just came in the room is Crawford Tuttle, who's the new chief deputy in forestry. I mentioned him in my comments. Crawford, raise your hand so you get to know folks in the room. Okay, great. Thanks. And the other one that just came in I see is Ryan Broderick, director. Snuck in the back door. You're gonna get to speak here pretty soon, I think. Okay, all right.
And may I add, we've just had joining us Jim Kellogg,
Hello,
who
Jim.
Served on this commission for 6 years. And was just reappointed to this commission.
Yes, he was.
So we have an esteemed commissioner joining us from Concord, California.
You want to give a speech? All right, Jim. Mm-hmm. See you.
I call you.
Questions or comments from anybody?
Before Ryan.
What's that?
Did I get here before Ryan?
You did, yes. Yeah, you did. You got here before Ryan. You did. That's right. You did.
Bud, did you have this?
Questions?
Questions or comments from anybody?
Commissioners, board members?
Well, I'll jump in. Secretary Kurzman, if you could give us a little bit of an update on the budget as we look at protection of the resources of the state, if we're seeing any hope in the budget process.
Good question. Yeah, there is. Revenues, of course, are significantly higher than we'd estimated. In fact, the latest estimates, it looks like we're going to be the tax revenues that we're collecting are about $4 billion ahead of what we thought they were going to be, which creates some nice challenges. These are the kind of challenges we really like to deal with. So for us in the agency, for us in the resources agency and the departments, you look at, and I know Ryan will talk at length about this, but, I mean, the work that Ryan and Greg Herner and other folks in the department have been doing on the budget for their department is very significant. The work that came out of the effort that came out of the legislature last year to kind of take a look to provide the kind of a transparent budget process for the department is really bearing fruit. A lot of help, a lot of folks in the conservation community, the business community, and the legislature across California have been great stepping up and helping us do that. So I think you'll see some real results of that this year. Again, from our perspective, we've asked for more dollars for the implementation of Marine Life Protection Act. We think we're going to get some more dollars there in the process. So for us, if you look at the budget, you look at the dollars that resources have. It's relatively small compared to expenditures in the human services area and other and education area and others in California. But we've got a tremendous amount of tremendous number of individuals who are there helping us to try to build those budgets, and we're making significant progress in that area. Public-private partnerships are something that we've been through these difficult budget times have been pushing really hard. MLPA is a prime example of those public-private partnerships. I think we're going to see more and more of that over time as we begin to bring in the private sector, bring in the foundations to help us on solving particular problems that we have given our budget constraints and challenges here in California. So I'm relatively optimistic that our budgets are going to be a little bit better this year. We'll focus on some of our priorities. Okay? Yep. Anything else? Okay. Thank you, Stan.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Richard, did you have a quick question?
You have a question? Hi, Richard.
I'm really concerned about the real development of partnerships, mm-hmm. notably fishing game, water quality, and the CDF. Actually making some progress in implementing. There's a lot of good words been said. There's been some efforts, for instance, the MOU between CDF and water quality to come up with a better process for cumulative impacts, but that paper came out a year and a half ago, I think they really need to do a blue ribbon panel or something to deal with these things on a steady basis, so that like fish and game representative needs to be people like yourself need to give direction so that all the agencies are at the right place at the right time to interact and really get a streamlined process that protects the resources well. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what I've heard rumors of work being done on a watershed coordination statewide, but I'm not sure if that's connected up with other processes that are going on regionally. I'm concerned that something that we is real be developed.
I'm sure you'll keep our feet to the fire on that, will you, Richard?
Okay, all right. Yeah.
No, it's a good point. And again, it's what we're trying to do. Public-private partnerships are difficult. I mean, they're not easy. And, you know, you have to remember that there is a public part of that, and there's of these partnerships and a private part of that. And so getting through the department cultures and the requirements that, again, that some of the foundations and the private sector put on the management of those dollars has been challenging, but we're gonna get there. I mean, we've made very significant strides in that effort in our MLPA process through the work of the Blue Ribbon Task Force and through the work of the folks in the Department of Fish and Game. And so, I think, quite frankly, that there's great hope here. But again, it's not easy, and it has to be an open and transparent process. People have to be involved. People have to understand that decisions are going to get made and not everybody's going to get what they want all the time. But at the end of the day, you're pushing that ball forward and you're making some real progress.
The COVID recovery team was a good
right.
start. Maybe that could be built upon.
Okay.
You know, something for all these different initiatives go by the wayside.
Okay. All right. David?
Yeah. Secretary Christman, I want to thank you for your letter of April 28th, where you encouraged the board and commission to work together toward a more streamlined regulatory process that would incorporate the mandates of the various departments, both the board, Department of Fish and Game, and California Department of Forestry. I just wonder if you'd like to add anything to that at this point.
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you. We have, and I think all of you know, that's been a very high priority of ours, is regulatory streamlining. Nobody's suggesting for a minute that what we want to do is somehow lessen the requirements, the regulatory requirements we have in some of these areas. But what we really have to do is we have to streamline the process. We have to bring more certainty into the regulatory process, and that's really what we're trying to do. The other effort that's going to be an integral to this is, of course, working with the State Water Resources Control Board and our regional boards. They are going to be a part of this and have been a part of our early discussions. And so this effort will not just be a resources agency directed effort, but we're going to be reaching to other agencies as time goes on, and we already are over to Cal EPA and the State Water Board. So again, your help and suggestions and nudging as we move this process forward would be very helpful. Okay.
Kind of going along with that question, if I may, Secretary Christman, how are we doing with the feds, like, for example, the Army Corps, on exactly those kinds of issues? Because the Army Corps figures, like in watershed protection districts, flood control districts, things like that, figures fairly heavily. And yeah. I understand they've sort of gotten religion recently.
Yeah, they have. Yeah, they have. I mean, and again, it's because we've worked pretty closely with them. And again, it's we have spent a lot of time. If you've all read the papers over the last few months, we've been spending a lot of time focusing on, given the kind of winter we have, given the kind of runoff that we know we're in the midst of now, given the condition of our levees, not only in Sacramento, San Joaquin area, but in the Delta area, but even south, it required us to identify some pretty, you know, some levees that were under very, we felt, immediate need of refurbishing. We've identified 29 or 30 of them. The president has essentially stepped up and has agreed to let the Army Corps of Engineers begin that process. We have just consummated an MOU with our federal partners that essentially leaves. We think that over time the state of California is going to get reimbursed for those dollars. We made it clear to our federal partners that absolutely we think that the feds need to step up over time and reimburse the state for the work that we're going to be paying for up front. But we have a new general here in California in the Corps. We have given the winter, we've spent a lot of time with them. There is new religion. There is new recognition that we've got to kind of push through some of these bureaucratic barriers that oftentimes stop the kind of projects that we need to protect life and property. And that's what this effort's been about this year and will continue to be.
If I may follow on with that. Because the timing, I applaud those efforts, because the timing is obviously very critical. If you run a watershed protection agency and you have to wait until the end of April approximately once the rains have come through, now you file for your clean-out permits, and if the regulatory process grinds slowly as it has in the past, and now you're pushing the end of the time period when these agencies can actually get it done, because if they do it after November or something like that, they're really exposed to actually not being able to get it done, and that means that the sediment load in those and therefore the water carrying capacity in those facilities is dramatically reduced, which means, and I'm familiar with a couple of them in Ventura County, we're on a critical cusp right now of entering the next rain season with a carrying capacity of about 3-year flood cycle on a major flood event. Flood carrying stream in Ventura County, and it's because the regulatory process on getting that thing done has been held up and held up and held up and held up. This is really going to be a problem for the state.
Yeah, we've recognized it. Again, these levee repairs that I talked about are going to get done this year. We're going to start them as soon as we can get in and get them done. They will be done by November. That's our commitment. That's the governor's commitment to our federal partners, and we got the commitment from the Army Corps to step up and be there to help us in that effort. So, we need to keep the focus on this. The unfortunate thing about it, Richard, is that the focus is usually only in high water years, and when you move on to other issues when you don't have the kind of winter we had. So again, we're gonna be pushing to try to keep this on everybody's radar screen over time, because we've got some very significant issues, particularly in the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta. We're going to be beginning a delta visioning process out there that recognizes that the deltas we know today is not sustainable. With the levee system we're doing an assessment, a delta risk management study right now, actually boring the levees, going out and taking a look at the structural integrity of the levees, and as a result of that we're going to know what levees are going to need the significant upgrading and work. It will allow the folks who will be making the decision on these to, you know, which of these levees are we going to enhance, which of these levees are we going to let go, what's going to be the makeup of the delta, what do we want the delta to look like over the next generation or two or three, because it simply is not sustainable, because 22 million people of California get their water out of it, and we've got to do a better job than we have. So another huge issue in this area, levee related and flood control related. Other questions or comments? Kirk?
I wonder, Mr. Secretary, if you could say a little bit on the whole question on the protection and recovery of anadromy. You know, this are the Board of Forestry is looking at extending the threatened and impaired package for some amount of time.
Right.
Fish and Game is obviously looking at their 2112 package. You talked a little bit about bringing the State Water Resource Control Board in. Give us a sense of some of the key aspects that, from where you sit on the 13th floor, that either of these commissions ought to be paying particular attention to.
Good question. I mean, and when Ryan speaks to you, Ryan can talk about a little bit of the efforts that he and his folks have been undertaking at the federal level, trying to get a 4D rule, trying to recognizing that there are opportunities both under the State Act and the Federal Endangered Species Act in these type of efforts. But the only thing I can say there, Kirk, is that we recognize that these species are under serious stress, more serious than other areas. We also recognize we've got to balance that protection that protection that's so necessary in many of those areas, with the, you know, with the proper management of those landscapes, making sure that the timber operators and other operators in those areas can continue to operate with a degree of certainty that in many instances they don't have. Our challenge in this regulatory effort is to try to bring certainty to these operations. I know oftentimes it's easier said than done, but if we can bring more certainty to the process, we can create these partnerships, create the kind of on the ground incentives for the recovery of these species, and at the same time protect these businesses and operators out there. Then I think we're heading in the right direction. But our big challenge, and our big challenge has to be in working in partnership with our federal partners on this.
Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Secretary,
yes.
Question on one of the things that the Board of Forestry has been looking at is some of the fuel reduction problems that we have in the state. And we've heard both here in the Tahoe Basin and even in the far end of the state in San Diego last month that there's a lack of conversion facilities or facilities to utilize some of the wood products or just the biomass for bioenergy in the state, in these regional areas, to help pay for some of the fuel reduction. Is the resource agency looking at any ways to develop new infrastructure and to help address some of that?
Yeah. I wish I could say we had some easy answer to that, but we don't. We recognized early on, we came in 2003 after the big fires up at Arrowhead, and we also recognized that we got some significant healthy forest dollars that came out of from the federal government, came from Congress to help us in some of the cleanup and some of those high fire prone areas in Southern California and San Bernardino and other forests in Southern California. But in terms of a recognition that we've got that biomass product that has to be moved, and then it has to be moved and stored somewhere. There's opportunities for additional biomass generation facilities. You look at the work of the Energy Commission, what the Energy Commission is doing right now. We have to create the markets for this sort of thing. We have to create the regulatory framework for the kind of private investment that it's going to take to bring some of that back. So we're looking a lot at that right now, particularly in the area of biomass in our area, that hopefully we'll be able to generate the kind of regulatory certainty and then hopefully incentives down the road for those kind of investments. But, you know, it goes back to the whole issue of the number of lumber mills and sawmills that we need to get the job done here in California. They're just not there in areas where we need them. I remember in the Arrowhead area in spring of 2004, they were having to haul the logs clear up to Ducor, the merchantable logs that were still merchantable, they could cut, had to haul them all the way up to Ducor to get a lot of that cut. And so, you know, we've got to figure a better way to get there. So any ideas you have would be very, very helpful. But again, on the biomass area, Energy Commission, the work we're doing right now is we're pushing that pretty hard.
Mike, I understand that you're going up to Humboldt County this week for a climate action team meeting. Could you maybe preview that for the board as well?
We are the governor's climate action efforts here in California. We're going to begin holding a number of workshops around California. We're going to be holding one on Thursday up in Humboldt, dealing with the forestry issues surrounding global warming and the possibilities there for a cap and trade effort in terms of carbon sequestration. Forestry plays a tremendous we have a tremendous opportunity with our forestry industries here in California to provide that kind of, we think, a pretty significant effort there. We're also looking to, a workshop in San Diego, oceans area, dealing with oceans. We're going to have another one actually up in Fresno that's going to be talking about biomass. Going to be talking about the biomass possibilities. And so there's a couple of others that I forget that are scattered around the state. We're going to be dealing with this issue of global warming, of essentially how we deal with this whole issue of you know, specifically reducing CO2 emissions to try to help mitigate over time. And our effort is going to be in trying to create a cap-and-trade incentive issue system here in California to make that happen. I know there's a lot of controversy. There will be a lot of debate, as there should be. This is an important issue, and there needs to be some significant public discussion about this, and these workshops are heading in that direction, we think.
We appreciate your efforts in that respect.
Thanks. Any advice or suggestions, we'd appreciate it from the board and other folks. Okay.
Other questions for the Secretary? Thank
thanks.
You very much,
thanks.
And thanks for taking the time to respond to questions. We'll move then to item four on this morning's agenda, which is a report from the director of CDF. Bill Crawford, are you representing the director?
Thank you very much, Chairman Dixon, and I'm going to make my remarks very brief and just introduce myself, commissioners and board members. I'm Crawford Tuttle, and I've just been given the distinct opportunity and pleasure to take on new responsibilities as the Chief Deputy Director at the Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. On behalf of Director Grijalva, we look forward to working very closely with the board, and obviously the commission as opportunity allows, and I just would want to amplify the comments made by the Secretary, how much the Department looks forward to working with Director Ryan Broderick and his new Chief Deputy Director, John McCammon, and finding better, more effective ways to achieve our high environmental standards in this area. What I wanted to do is just, again, thank you very much. I will plan on allowing Deputy Director Snyder to make our formal report, but I just wanted to express how excited I am to have this privilege and look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you very much.
Congratulations on your new position, and thanks for being here this
pleasure.
Morning. Bill?
Board members, commission members, Bill Snyder, Deputy Director for Resource Management for the Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. Ruben sends his apologies for not being able to be here today. I had some long-standing commitments, but in his stead, I'm going to give you the department's report today. I'm pleased to announce that the governor did appoint Director Grijalva as the director. He's no longer the acting director of the department, and we have a new chief deputy director, Crawford Tuttle, whom you just met, and as a result, I've been moving around offices and stacking books and doing other sorts of things here and there, but we're really pleased to have Crawford on board. I think he'll bring a lot of energy and policy looking forward pieces that we'll be able to make good use of. With respect to the budget, we did receive word that the Department of Finance had signed our $8 million deficiency request, and that'll be moving forward to the legislature. And we'll be seeking funding through a supplemental appropriations bill. That should cover the $8 million hole that we had in the department's budget and allow us to move forward with planning for the fire season and in a little more strategic way as opposed to something that was more budget-driven. Our discussions with the Department of Finance and DPA continue relative to the inversion issues. There really is nothing to report, but those discussions are ongoing. And as soon as we do get some word on potential resolution to that problem, we'll certainly let the board know. Our 0607 budget, we have had the first series of hearings, both Department of both Natural Resources and Senate and the Assembly side. A few issues remain to be resolved, one dealing with our FRIF budget. We have been directed to look at potential ways of funding some of our FRIF programs rather in some other form rather than using FRIF dollars. We're also looking at some CAPCOM questions that we need to resolve, and there are still some outstanding issues relative to use of Prop 40 money for our urban forestry programs. But the basic pieces of the budget have moved forward, and those three primary areas remain unresolved. Program-wise, we are continuing to participate in the COHO recovery team. Dwayne Shintaku has attended a new meeting here recently. And that effort is still moving forward and ongoing. In response to some board direction Previously, we have developed a Hot Topics piece to be posted on the Internet to allow foresters to get the latest information in terms of THP interpretation policies and other sorts of actions on the part of the department relative to harvest plan preparation. We have reached agreement with the Department of Fish and Game relative to some interdepartmental training, which will take place in October of 06. This is kind of along the lines of the old Watershed Academy. We'll be working out the logistics of that over the next coming months and look forward to that interdepartmental training piece. We have also looked at forming a committee to look at some of the technical issues relative to coho and water quality, focused specifically on hydrologic connectivity relative to road systems and how we might address that better in our planning processes, looking at crossing removal and removal of crossings and potential impacts to coho. And also we are looking at potential of identifying where we might have diversion at crossing locations down roads, which could contribute sediment. I believe we have worked out a lot of the technical issues and in the process of forming a committee. The intent would to be issue a technical report relative to things that would need to be considered by those preparing plans and those reviewing plans as it relates to those issues. We have completed our floodplains technical document. That's been out and available for folks to review. It gives some advice and guidance relative to things that need to be considered when timber operations are planned in floodplains adjacent to rivers. We are moving along substantially with our pilot project relative to the interagency monitoring process. That process is designed to look at how effective our crossings and mitigations are relative to THPs, how well those have been executed. And I believe the pilot is pretty well set in place. We're going to be using some standardized methodology developed by Cal EPA for evaluating crossing locations, and the focus initially will be on crossings and crossings removals. We are looking at some programmatic approaches to watershed planning. We have the two MRCs, which is Mattole Restoration Council, as well as Mendocino Redwood Company, have both approached the department relative to looking at programmatic EIRs for timber operations and other types of activities at a relatively large scale. And we're looking forward to moving forward with those issues. A lot of things to be dealt with yet, but those, I think, get to some of the issues that Richard is talking about relative to taking a bigger look on a more programmatic landscape basis at some of these issues. The department has been very engaged in the climate change piece, particularly as forests relate to carbon sequestration, and we will be participating fairly heavily here Thursday at the meeting up in Eureka. We've also been looking at some of the bioenergy pieces, looking at potential for forest residues to be used for not only energy generation through the typical cogeneration plants, but also looking at its utility as biofuels, either biodiesel or cellulosic ethanol. And we've also been looking at biomass opportunities relative to combinations of technologies that will allow us to improve the existing technologies, improve recovery in terms of efficiency, and look forward to those moving forward as well. The Western State Foresters meeting will be here in Lake Tahoe next week. And a couple of things that are going to be on the table is looking at the Climate Action Registry and how we go about measuring carbon and registering that carbon in California. California is uniquely positioned by virtue of the registry and the forestry protocols to situate itself for cap and trade. Prop 40, relative to fuel treatments here in the Sierra Nevadas, we are going through our second round of community assistance grants. Roughly about $3 million will be awarded to project proponents for fuel reduction activities. Some of those projects will be here in the basin. We also have about $600,000 going to the California Conservation Corps for fuel treatment here in the basin, primarily on Tahoe Conservancy lands. We're also moving forward now with the Vegetation Treatment Programmatic Environmental Impact Report. I could have given you the acronym for that, but I thought at this point in the presentation it would be better to see if my tongue was still working. But that effort will look at looking at a programmatic process for treating fuels and how that impacts other related forest values, including water quality and wildlife. We're looking forward to moving that piece. But that concludes our report for this morning. And, Stan, I guess I'll entertain any questions if people have questions.
Thank you very much. Please pardon my voice. Well-equipped here with the halls and everything else here, trying to keep operating today. I'd like to spend a couple minutes, if we can, evaluating the effect of the pension situation that that the governor and the department addressed. I'd specifically be interested to know, given the report that we got at our San Diego meeting, what type of vacancy situation are we looking at in the various positions that was created prior to the loophole being closed? And if you could walk us through how the loophole specifically was closed, what action was taken in that regard? And as we go into next year's fire season, what is the impact of that in terms of vacancies? What's the situation likely to be as we go into the next fire season as a result of that?
I'll certainly do my best, and I'm not an expert relative to the pension piece, but there was a decision by DPA relative to how pensions could be calculated that led to some, in essence, double counting for years of service, which allowed some employees, because of service in two different areas, one being bargaining unit 8 and one being supervisory, to combine those to get more than a 90% rate of retirement. Ron, that's as far as I'm going to be able to go. Now, they did attempt to close that loophole, I believe they did. The specific mechanisms, I just saw the director's memo the other day. I haven't had a chance to talk to him, look at the specific mechanism, but that loophole was in essence dealt with by DPA. The problem relative to retirements, I think, is not so much related to that issue, although certainly that was a driver for some individuals in terms of the decision process, but it gets to just the age of some of our upper supervisory folks, and you know, their impending retirements is based upon that age, and the inversion issue, which is creating a situation where people are reluctant to promote into supervisory positions within the department. Now, as I said, we're still working on trying to address that inversion piece, but I'm not sure what the solution is. Director's been pretty forthright in telling us that he's working on it, but he really can't tell us many of the details. But that solving that inversion piece is going to be very important relative to our capability to move people from the battalion chief ranks into division chiefs and on up through the management positions. Without that, I think we are probably for this fire season going to be in relatively good shape in terms of our ability to field command teams. But we are seeing some problems developing over the course of potentially next fire season. And I don't know, Wayne might have a little more specifics on that as well. Did that get to most of the issues, Ron?
Well, I seem to recall at the San Diego meeting, if memory serves correct, and it could be altered by the various things I'm taking here, but a vacancy rate of up to 50% in some supervisory levels, is that right? Is there a 50% vacancy rate in some levels within the department?
There's potential for that, yeah. And I think it's some of the specific operating units that may have already occurred.
And do you believe that a 50% vacancy rate does not inhibit fire protection abilities on the part of the department?
Absolutely not. And it's an issue that we're dealing with, and there are a number of things that factor into that piece relative to how to deal with the inversion, how to get people to move into the supervisory ranks, and then looking at you know, the depth of experience in fire delivery. But we're trying to deliver that piece of that this summer. And I know the director has been very actively engaged with Department of Finance, DPA, and the governor's office relative to a need for a fix.
Good morning. My name is Wayne Mitchell. I'm Assistant Deputy Director in Fire Protection for Planning and Prevention. I'll attempt to answer the questions basically what Chief Snyder had to say was about all I can offer. We are looking at the team situation. We typically staff 10 command teams. This year we've already moved to 9 command teams just because of the vacancies and looking at what we can field. Right now we're on the bubble looking at going back to 10 or possibly going to 8 as we look at the mix of people that we have through the system. We're continuing to query our folks and find out who's available. We're currently in the process of putting together an inventory of our retirees, recent retirees, those that would be available to come back to work on a kind of an as-call or on-call basis to staff out the larger incidents. So we're getting that inventory together as we speak. That request went out last week. So in the meantime, we're also watching the inversion solution as it's being worked on by Chief Grijalva and the administration. We're waiting to see what impact that'll have. Most of our firefighting effort is, of course, with our battalion chiefs, fire captains, you know, those ranks. And we're confident that we do have, you know, a significant amount of resources available for this summer. The other issue that we're addressing and is with these retirements, not only the inversion problem and that's creating, but just the number of retirements that we're seeing this winter and going into next year, is the spin-off impact on our entry-level employees. Ultimately, these all mean we're hiring new employees at some point. We are gearing up more training classes to get operators for our equipment, you know, our company-level officers. We're adding some additional training, not only at the academy, but also down at Clark Training Center in Riverside and up in the Magalia Training Center up in Butte County. We'll be offering company officer training classes to bring on more of our engine operators. So it is a difficult time. We do have solutions that we're working through and getting in place. The word on the budget that we just got about the fix that finance is going to offer for us with the deficiency request is helping tremendously to relieve some of that pressure.
If I may. It would seem to me that part of the reason why this strikes me as odd or is potentially significant is that if you have an unusual vacancy rate in lower support staff that doesn't require certain skill sets and such, you can hire people, you can move people into those positions. But if you have a band of vacancies in a supervisorial level position, then it seems to me that you could be in a position where you are promoting people up through the ranks prematurely before they're ready for those positions in order to fill the boxes in the grid. Is that a danger?
That is a very, very serious issue that we're looking at. And we have a team that we've called our we used to call it changing face, but we don't call it that now. that was an old term. We had to come up with a new one. But we do have a group that's looking at that. Part of it is the training level that we bring our folks in, entry level. To work in a brand-new employee into the fire protection series, it takes a three-year JAC program, the Joint Apprenticeship Program, before they're eligible to promote on up in the system. And that gives them that journey-level training to move on up. There's then a couple of years at the captain level to promote on up into the battalion chief. So it's not a very fast process to promote people before they're ready. Along with that, we're looking at a mentoring program. Part of the reorganization that was done last summer was to free up more of our upper-level administrators and our executive team to work more closely with some of the folks that are promoting up in the management series and mentor them in their assignments as they grow into their new responsibilities. Just in our unit chief ranks, we saw the turnover occurring, and I think right now we've got probably a little over 50% of our unit chiefs are brand new within the last 6 months. So we're doing quite a bit of work with them one-on-one and working them through what it means to be a unit chief. So those are some of the added kinds of things that we're doing to grow our folks in. The stress on our system is that we are not bringing people in that are unqualified and unprepared to do those assignments. we're doing everything we can to take those that are facing that step as the next step in their career and preparing them as quickly as we can to grow them into those assignments.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Chairman?
Yeah, I have a question. This may be better for Deputy Director Schneider, or perhaps not, Wayne. Maybe handle it. The public perception of that retirement double dipping is pretty heavy. I personally have received a lot of emails simply because I used to be on the Board of Forestry. People in positions of importance wondering what the hell was going on. Did guys actually get the 115% that's been bandied about, and are they going to keep it?
I don't know about the 115% number, Richard, but I think there were instances where the actual calculated rate was more than 90% that would have been allowed under a standard retirement. But as far as the number, total numbers of people who took advantage of that and what the maximum was, I can't answer that. But it did occur.
Yeah, needless to say, there's a fairly significant credibility problem out there with the public.
Although I think a lot of that was driven by DPA and DPA rulings relative to the various retirement systems under the bargaining unit agreements. So I know there is a perception that it was under department control, and I think even some of the latest newspaper articles seem to indicate that. But it certainly was an issue that we didn't have as much control as everybody was indicating we did.
Other questions from commissioners or board members?
I really don't want to get in a debate. If you've got some, can you hold it for your public forum comments? Okay.
I'd like to say I appreciate hearing
you. My name is Craig Bell, and I just want to say I'm happy to hear about the watershed interagency training. The Fisheries Environmental Restoration Community has been urging that occur for about 10 years. And I would just like to ask, is Water Quality Control Board staff, regional staff, going to be included in this, considering their overlapping and authorities over water quality related to timber harvest practices?
There are a couple of issues there. One, as we look at some of these technical papers relative to how to provide some guidance to people, water quality clearly will be involved in that piece. With respect to the interdepartmental training for the Watershed Academy piece of that, I think probably, Duane, you may have a little more of an update in terms of who all will be included in that part of the training.
Good morning, board members. Duane Shintaku, Assistant Deputy Director with Forest Practice. Craig, to answer your question, as Bill indicated, we've assigned Pete Caffaret as our lead to bring together a group of department representatives, including water quality, and then the typical other review team agencies, people that we feel have the expertise and experience to help develop these training documents that we're referring to. Initially, we have just coordinated through Banky and Kevin Hunting an interdepartmental training with Fish and Game this summer. Not to say that if discussion with water quality leads us to bringing them on board to participate as well, we certainly would welcome that. We just want to make sure we don't act too ambitiously and assume that we're going to get that support from the other several regional boards that we deal with. And that's the reason right now we're just ironing things out with Fish and Game, but hopefully we'll develop that. Does that answer your question?
Thanks, Dwayne. Other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay.
I think we'll take about a 5-minute break now and then come back and
I can find the director.
Right there.
Oh, there he is. Oh, I'm sorry, Ryan. Director Broderick, welcome.
President Flores, members of the Fish and Game Commission, members of the Board of Forestry, thank you very much. I'm Ryan Broderick, Director of the Department of Fish and Game. I'd like to quickly introduce the staff that's in attendance, because frankly they do a lot of the day-to-day work and interrelationship between CDF and the industry and the NGO community. Deputy Director Banky Curtis, would you raise your hand? Thank you. Deputy Director Sankey Maestrup. I have from Region 2, and you were in Region 2 of Department of Fish and Game, Kent Smith. Gail Newton, I believe, is behind me from Fisheries. They left. I scared them out already. John McCammon, I hope, was introduced earlier. He's the recently appointed Chief Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Game. And Gail, raise your hand, please. You'll be hearing from Gail later on. Kevin Hunting is a branch chief in Sacramento and responsible for a lot of the watershed training and General Endangered Species Act issues. So that's the entire brain trust of the Department of Fish and Game. No, that's not quite, but it seems like it at times. It's a pleasure to be here. We have a fascinating interrelationship with the Board of Forestry from your regulatory role and with the commission, and certainly the performance of those regulatory roles in the policy discussions between the Department of Fish and Game and CDF. A couple interesting notes. I hope they're interesting general updates. I know that issues of budget are of interest, but I would like to note the support of the current director and prior director in establishing a joint academy for our basic post at Ione. It's housed at the CDF Academy. It just had a graduation last Friday, and many of the members of CDF were in very appropriate Class A uniforms. And we graduated a combined class of CDF peace officers, post-standard certificated folks, Fish and Game wardens, and state parks personnel. So this is the first time in the history of the Resources Agency that actually three of the resource agency departments combined for a post-basic academy. I'd like to let you know that the top folks in that class, there's 7,500 points. That's the kind of the total number of potential points you get in all the curriculum areas of the post curriculum. And the folks that were at the top of that class and in competition with only points apart were in the 7,150 range. So out of a possible 7,500 points in the post curriculum, they were within 300 points of 250 points of perfection. And I would suggest that since post standards are common across all law enforcement in California, that you'd be hard-pressed to find any agency, whether it be, I won't name the agencies, you would be hard-pressed to find any law enforcement agency that has cadets that graduate that high in terms of total points accrued. Having said that, I'm proud of it, but I won't belabor it. But I think it does kind of lead into this was probably a cultural transition that needed to occur some time ago, but it was forced by budgets. Since 2000, 2001, in the Department of Fish and Game, as a baseline year, we were down 460 employees across the department. We'll hear today from the public and from the – I'll back up. I'm spitting on the mic, I guess. You will hear from the public and certainly from our department the efforts are being made on training, whether it be water quality and watersheds, training as it relates to developing cross-jurisdictional streamlining. You will have discussions and interest in pushing the conservation ball as it relates to new and exciting practices both on the ground and in conservation strategies such as working landscape easements. And all of those are necessary and critical to the performance of our respective duties, the implementation of your respective policies for future generations of the state and for the economic well-being of our working landscapes and future generations of wildlife, but they all take personnel. So from the department's perspective, forestry is a huge and diverse landscape. We're deeply committed to continuing the stewardship of that resource while at the same time, as Secretary Chrisman noted, we have major efforts underway on the ocean under the Marine Life Protection Act, continued implementation on the Marine Life Management Act. We have an unparalleled focus on the Bay Delta at the moment, trying to determine the decline of pelagic organisms of the Delta that you may have noted. We have opportunities across the state from, you know, San Diego to Del Norte and from Siskiyou down to the backside of Imperial and County in the conservation arena. And we are committed with the 1,600 employees that we have to provide as much due diligence, and obviously that requires prioritization. In the budget process, we have had bipartisan interest and concern in terms of the mandates of the Department of Fish and Game and the ability to fund those mandates. We had a budget this year. Budgets usually close, you know, by November. It's done. It's cooked. It's baked. The discussions are over. This year in our budget discussions, we had issues that were still being discussed into mid-December. Since the governor's budget was announced in January, we've had ongoing discussions with the Department of Finance and the Legislative Analyst Office and leadership of the governor's office. And there's a little term called finance letters that are usually an interim measure after the budget is provided and before the May revise. The department had 21 finance letters this year, 14 of which were approved. So I would suggest, in my experience since 1981 with, unfortunately before that, 1977 in state service, that is unprecedented in my experience in terms of making the budget much more adaptive than typically we saw. Usually you deferred, Commissioner Rogers referenced permits, and if you lose a work season, you lose a year. It's the same thing in budgets, but in this particular case, we're seeing an interest in adapting and working into the May revise. Our budget items are still left open both in the Assembly and the Senate, so the final story has not been sung. But I think we have provided an incredible amount of transparency in our budget, both to the LAO's office, the Department of Finance, and the respective leadership on the subcommittees of our budget, and to leadership in the respective parties and houses. We are encouraged that with the approval of the finance letters that people are continue to be engaged in providing us relief on budget issues. We have 35. I talked about MLPA, the POD. Obviously, Secretary Chrisman referenced the Klamath discussions or the Klamath issues, and you all have watched the dialogue and the interest between the state and the setting of the Pacific Fisheries Management Council recommendations. I think it underscores, you know, realistically, the common bond we have, and the fact that everything in the state, and in fact into Oregon, especially as it relates to salmonids, we're all linked at the hip. We can manage discrete watersheds, and we do. We can improve the management of a collection of watersheds, and we do. We can improve the management of individual species of fish. The reality is that they commingle in the ocean, and that's the common denominator. And this year, the initial recommendations from the National Marine Fisheries Service, and Charlotte's here to talk about that later from National Marine Fisheries Service. But let's just leave it at the fact that it was a very strong interactive discussion of both the science, driven by the science and statistics team. We recognize the long-term recovery of salmon is based on the watershed, not necessarily on just the regulation at the gate of the ocean. We do have a restricted commercial season this year, and restricted recreational season driven by Klamath Chinook stocks. That's the bad news. The good news is that it's provided, I think, a reaffirmation that you have to have fairly holistic solutions, and that no one regulation, no one body can dictate the ultimate recovery. You all have to kind of contribute in a synergistic fashion. You've indicated an earlier discussion in terms of our efforts with the CDF. Obviously, we have the state coho listing. That is in the courts as we speak. However, the issue in terms of the federal listing in 96 and a way to integrate the federal and the state, and when I say state, both CDF Fish and Game and the regional board and state board's interest on water quality. That discussion is continuing. I had a conference call with Dr. Hogarth, head of National Marine Fisheries Service, on Friday. That was followed up by a meeting with Jim Leckie and Ron McGinnis and Russell Strzok, which is the principals both in Washington and in California, yesterday. We're committed to continuing to try to tease together apart and then tease together a regulatory solution and objectives that meet the regulatory requirements while at the same time provide some certainty and alternatives for the working landscapes as well as certainty for the recovery of the fisheries. And that's going to be an ongoing process. It has to be transparent. We have taken our package out to anybody and everybody. I refer to Mark Stouffer as the carrier of my pinata when it comes to getting constructive comments on what we need to do that is, in fact, going to meet the regulatory requirements of the Board of Forestry and the issues that we've raised through the Coho Recovery Plan. Gail Newton, later in the agenda, will give you an overview of the Coho Recovery Plan, and then later in the agenda you address the common salmonids policy and steelhead and trout coastal trout issues before the two commissions. I guess that you've heard this before. We're continuing to work on the solutions from a regulatory standpoint, and the general objective is to continue to work and to bring in those private interests and those foundation interests. I think the evolution of forestry conservation is, it's a constantly moving and I think evolving product. Last week we had the opportunity to sit down with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, the Pacific Forest Trust, and they had received a grant from Walmart, and it was specified and focused on a conservation easement on the Bascom Pacific Forest. That's not the only solution, but it is a major, I think, evolving contribution to forestry conservation, and hopefully from an economic standpoint for the folks that choose to exercise a sale of a conservation easement. As mentioned earlier, in terms of the programmatic EIR, we are working on a natural communities conservation plan, a federal habitat conservation plan with Mendocino Redwoods. That's been a very open and transparent process, and I have very high hopes, and this is based on fact, not just hopes, that by January, if not before, we'll have a document on the streets, and that will go through full CEQA and NEPA review. So those are just some of the brief highlights, and I think that I'll leave it to questions, but I know that you've watched in the press a variety of issues on the Klamath. You've watched issues on retention and recruitment. I've heard some of the questions earlier as it relates to personnel, and I just say ditto for Fish and Game in terms of recruitment and retention. I do have employees that wish they got in that sliver of time on the DPA rule, but that didn't happen in our bargaining unit. But I think it is an ongoing issue for the Department of Fish and Game. With that, I'll entertain questions, and please understand a lot of the specifics in the Coho Recovery Team, or the Coho Recovery Plan, and the team that's going on there, and the work that's being on the Watershed Academy will be addressed by folks that know it in more detail. But thank you for the opportunity to have the opportunity to make a brief presentation, and I think it's critical to see the interspersion and interaction between the Board of Forestry and the Fish and Game Commission. You are our policy direction, and the regulatory frameworks that you adopt are the only way we can promote and continue our conservation ethic in California.
Okay. Any questions?
Mic's work.
Thank you. Well, first of all, Mr. Director, I was happy to opportunity to see you sing for your supper in front of the Senate Budget Subcommittee, and as well as your chief warden. And I thought, under sometimes hostile questioning, you did an excellent job in representing the interests of the department and trying to get the legislature, inviting them to be real partners rather than critics. And your whole team, I thought, was effective.
Thank you.
As I listened, trying to bang on one of the members and get him off the dais to talk about what I needed to talk to him about.
You succeeded, as I recall.
He voted the wrong way. We got him up the dais, but he voted the wrong way.
Keep him up at the dais.
And it wasn't on your item, I assure you. I just want to bring you back. You sent us a letter, I think, last month around the T&I rules and the importance of them as part of the mosaic, as you were referring to, about recovery. And just wondered if you and maybe you want one of your other team members to talk about, you know, not only what the T&I rule package and why that's important, but also what the other pieces of the puzzle from a regulatory or a non-regulatory perspective might be in terms of increasing the likelihood of the recovery and the thoroughness of the recovery.
I'll start generally. I'm going to have Banky work his way over here, but in the interim. First of all, the T&I rules, in the view of the department, if we can integrate that with some of the enhancements that we tried to establish and have put forward and discussed with both industry and members of the COA recovery team as well as the water boards, if we can integrate those two, then our feeling is that we have a package that will be sufficient, and this is subject to Charlotte's blessing, that we'll have a package to work with in terms of the 4D package, and we'll have a recovery strategy that is a little more holistic. I am very impressed with the work that was done by the recovery plan, the T&I rules, and let's be honest, from the industry standpoint, the T&I rules were sufficient. From the standpoint of the department, the T&I rules were good, but we didn't feel they met some of the requirements necessary for the recovery and conservation of threatened and endangered species. I'm not going to debate the relative merits, and I respect everyone's position on that, but the reality is if we can meld the two in a fashion that the T&I rules, and because of your programmatic environmental compliance or functional equivalence provisions, it's a potential vehicle, and this isn't making it a done deal, but a potential vehicle that we could get these provisions on the ground faster than waiting for the court decision, which we will have to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to use this as a backdoor way of upholding the listing. That's for the court to establish. But if on a improved health of the watershed basis, the basis of improved predictability for folks doing forestry and timber operations, and in a fashion that we can show is a continued contribution and setting the stage for recovery of endangered species and contributing to their recovery, then I think we've got a package that has some synergy and something that we can take to our federal counterparts and say, you know, we asked you 2 years ago to adopt our COA recovery plan, and with all respect to Dr. Hogarth and Jim Leckie and Ron McGinnis, you know, that's not something they can just adopt, but we think we had a fairly substantial and effective document. If that helps bridge, you know, the regulations helps bridge so that we can get a 4D ruling, at least for that area where they're threatened, we'll hopefully provide some long-term relief and streamlining in the permitting. Now, the question will come up, what about the endangered issue, and why would you apply it in the endangered area if there's no benefit under 4D? And I'm not going to put words in Charlotte's mouth, because I'll let her address it if she chooses, but we still would be doing the monitoring and practices that would help document the uplisting in the endangered area to threatened, where 4D then is, you know, applicable. So we want to try to design this so it has multiple utility. Now I'm going to ask my deputy director, with my permission, to correct all my falsehoods. So
just before you do, but so if I understand that right, then the T&I are a necessary building block. The enhancements, in order to then have more active consideration or thorough consider for 4D, are then pieces of the puzzle that the department's put forth in the recovery team.
Correct.
In the recovery plan.
Essentially, yeah.
Great.
And I need to give everyone credit from the folks on the landscape, the NGOs doing the recovery, the timber interest doing the recovery, and you as regulators. It's a view of my hard-bitten cynics in the department that have been doing forestry for a long while, the last 10 years, that there has been real and significant improvement on the ground. Banky, do you have anything to add there or contradict?
Well,
I'd like to add just a little bit, certainly not to contradict anything. I think Ryan was absolutely right on. What I want to do is take advantage of this opportunity to say just a few words and to say that, you know, we've been working very closely with CDF this last year or so, and I've been very impressed. Dwayne Shintako, Bill Snyder, Jenny Chan, the whole group, Crawford Tuttle was helping with that group, have really been open. And I think as we've gotten together and discussed things, the conclusion we've come to is the only way we can deal with these issues is by working together. And to do that, we have to make some very sound and fundamental cultural changes. And so we started doing some of those things. And Ryan mentioned one of them was the Joint Resources Academy for the law enforcement officer. We've been working very closely with Dwayne to try to work out some opportunities to give joint training for some of our peoples and their people together so we're seeing the same thing. I think the idea of adding the water quality folks to that is extremely important. It is a really good point to be able to do that. But frankly, I have been very impressed by the openness of CDF, their willingness to take a look at this, the willingness to take on these issues head on and to recognize the only way we can accomplish the goals of the Board of Forestry and the goals of the Fish and Game Commission is to work jointly together to do that. So I've been very impressed with that. I think Ryan's point that as we look at the 2112 rules, the timber harvest rules, the 1600 rules, all of those things have to be integrated. Secretary Crisman has been very encouraging, let me use that word, of streamlining that and getting those processes so they're integrated, so they're working together. He's made it very clear that that's where he wants us to go. And that's the direction we've been working hard to be able to do that. I think it will take some time to change some cultures, but I think as we get the people working together, being trained together, being told the same thing together, we can begin to accomplish those. So I'm very excited and encouraged about that opportunity. And I think the other thing we have to do, as Ryan mentioned, is bring in Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fish as part of that team and the Corps of Engineers. Sometimes there's more challenges than others, but it can be done. Just on another note, just to show you some of the challenge that can be done between agencies, and I know some of you are familiar with it, we have a mitigation banking program. And to apply for a mitigation bank, Fish and Game had its rules, NOAA Fisheries had its rules, Fish and Wildlife Service had its rules, and the Corps of Engineers. We've actually been able to jointly agree on one template, one form that works for all the agencies. Now, that doesn't sound very big, but that's huge. That's absolutely huge. Yep. So if we can do that, I think we can integrate the timber harvest rules, the 2112 regs, the 1600, the federal regulations. If we can bring those all together, I think we really have accomplished something that we can all be proud of. So if there's any other questions, I'd be happy to respond to those.
Okay.
No, but I would just say that your enthusiasm is contagious, and I think every member of this board and this commission not only wants to experience the enthusiasm, but the reality of when this all comes together and people in the state of California say, can you believe that this state has agencies and departments that actually work together to serve the public?
Wouldn't that be great?
It is a good process, and as I say, I just want to commend you for your leadership in it, and hope that we see it all come to fruition this year. This year,
we hope so. We're making progress. We're taking steps. The one thing I didn't add to that was Dwayne has been very involved in helping us realize the value of doing some of the studies together. So we'll actually do some joint monitoring. We're going to actually try to get some of our folks jointly agree on a monitoring program to see how well the timber harvest rules are working so we can go out and jointly agree on the process and come on the conclusion. Are they too strict? Are they not strict enough? Where are they being modified? And I think that will go a long ways at improving things as well. So I think a lot of credit goes to CDF and their leadership as well.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I agree with you entirely. Banky's enthusiasm is very, very infectious, although I don't want to talk about it. And frankly, I think you guys are really working on something that is critical. I mean, absolutely critical. It's what Secretary Crisman's really motivated about, one of the things, which is to really clean up the process. And it's only going to work if guys like you show the kind of enthusiasm and diligence to make this process, because you are dealing with cultural change, and as we all know, that takes forever if you don't really push on it. And I really applaud your efforts. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Banky. Thank you, Ryan.
Just a quick amendment. I'd be remiss. I didn't introduce Marty Burbach, and Marty's been the liaison for the Department of Fish and Game of the Board of Forestry, and he wasn't sitting right here when I went through the announcements, and my apologies, Marty. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
President.
Yes. Question for the director.
Yes.
Director Broderick, we're discussing the T&I rules and their importance in the processes that are going on. And the Board of Forestry is currently looking at those rules through one of our committees to look at doing a review of those rules, partly because they were and have the name of interim rules and have a sunset date. So we're seriously reviewing those rules or undertaking a process. But it appears that that process needs to include what the department's doing. And I would hope that the department, and I think we have that support with your representative there to embark on this review, because with all of our rules, the science and knowledge that we have about fisheries and the impacts of forest management on fisheries and watersheds is a continually improving set of knowledge, and I would hope we would feel that a review of the interim rules is appropriate. But I wasn't sure if I got that from your statement as far as whether these T&I rules are a static fixture now or whether or not we should even be embarking on a review.
Well, first of all, in science, if you don't do a periodic and transparent and honest review, you're going to be sort of disappointed in the results, has been my experience. So I think the review is appropriate, and I think bringing the information from all sources that you have in terms of their effectiveness and applicability is an important dialogue to have. We're committed to having that dialogue. And this isn't just in the reign of forestry. I'll give you a parallel example. The Department of Fish and Game has been monitoring pursuant to water right conditions placed in the Bureau of Reclamation and the Bureau and the Department of Water Resources on exports out of the Delta. And so we had probably the finest long-term data set on fisheries anywhere in the world, frankly. And yet we had an unanticipated decline in Delta smelt to historic levels. And one of the lessons that came out of that, and lessons are still emerging, was that monitoring is critical. Synthesis gives you direction. And synthesizing that data and pulling all the pieces together oftentimes gives you a broader and more effective understanding of what's happening in the resource than the individual species. And from that, you emerge with a better conservation strategy. And so I think the science and the premise of the T&Is were appropriate for the time in which they're done, but I am a sole purporter of an honest, transparent review of the premises, because the science doesn't change, but our understanding of what we monitored and what it meant certainly does in terms of restoration, recovery of the landscape and our species. That's a long-winded answer to a damn simple question. I apologize.
Well, I appreciate the answer, because unfortunately it's not going to be a simple process to review them, but I do appreciate your support of that review and would hope that I think one of the other things that has come up with COHO is the recovery efforts and planning process. And though protection and maintenance of habitat is one issue, the recovery through the recovery process is another factor. And hopefully now with that recovery plan there, we can have that input and expertise that was developed through that recovery plan to be integrated into our review of the rules and how the authorities under the Forest Practices Act would allow us to integrate some of that. So I think it's become a more complex issue rather than just maintenance of habitat and conditions and reduction or minimization of impacts. But, you know, we do have more to offer as well as the department. So with your support of that, I think that'll be a big a good effort to go through the science review
look
and
forward to it.
Take our time to do it right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Breden. Actually, a comment first, Director, and then a question. I appreciate hearing both your comments about the need to have the cooperative efforts and from the Secretary also. And, Banky, I'm glad to hear that things are looking better out in the woods. But I think we need to remember that's in part from certainly there have been regulatory changes, but there have also been a lot of cooperative efforts with the public and public agencies and private landowners, and I think this the video that we've been given is a great example of that a lot of the culverts which were formerly fish blockages are no longer blockages, and in part it's completely out of the regulatory framework. It was done through cooperative efforts, identification of problems, and then the implementation of the necessary repairs. So I encourage us to continue to work forward in that non-regulatory cooperative effort also to identify problems and to work with landowners, especially given what something like 85 or 90% of the coho habitats on private lands. So we look forward to continuing to develop those other non-regulatory types of programs. The question, your comment about working with National Fisheries Service in an attempt to develop a 4D, I reviewed a letter, it was about 6 months ago, that identified the initial response that wasn't overly optimistic. Have there been more conversations since then, and could you bring us up to date on that status?
That letter and the 8 points that were raised by NOAA was a specific agenda on Friday to put a relative scale and bar on those 8 points that were raised. I'll let Charlotte address some of those, but understand it was a work in progress as of Friday. But, you know, I felt from the discussion we had with Russ Strock and Rod McGinnis and with Jim Leckie, we put some texture and context to the bullet points. If you could read into some of the bullet points, if you were a pessimist like Banky, we're not going to go there. I think we got a better understanding of what we can accomplish and a much better sense on Friday that there's a reason to invest the time and energy, understanding it's all about priorities, and we wouldn't be doing it if we thought we were running into a blind alley. Although I've made some U-turns in blind alleys lately, but I'm trying to avoid them wherever we can. But I'm encouraged that we can make an effort. And I think the take-home message that from that meeting was essentially, yes, this is a pretty steep mountain to climb, but the backside benefits of it are so intense and so significant that it's worth, you know, making a push to try to meet those points and as modified in the discussion. Because a long-term durability of that 4D rule would provide some of the certainty and I think some of the synthesis that will make us more productive both as agencies and as private landowners, as public landowners, and as the NGO restoration community.
If I may, Gary, just to add one other thing to your comment about public-private partnerships in this tape, no one wants to go through budget problems such as the departments, plural, have had to go through. Fish and Game is currently involved in, but those sorts of things are sort of necessity is the mother of invention, and Fish and Game is currently involved in the development of several public-private partnerships where the results are really critical. I mean, these are on endangered areas, and so it's really an important thing that I think the departments, plural, are embarking on. These changes in breaking down in cultures, I think, are really hard to do, but really well worth the effort.
Thank you.
Really like what's happening.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to change paths a little bit and go to item number 8. Go ahead, Gail.
morning, board members and commissioners. I'm Gail Newton with the Fisheries Branch in the Department of Fish and Game. As some of you may recall, last year, both departments suggested that we update the joint policy on Pacific salmon and anadromous trout. So that's what we've been doing. And in your package, you should have the modified policy. And I just want to highlight some of the main changes and let you know that these changes were coordinated extensively within the Department of Fish and Game across our regions and also with Bill Snyder, Deputy Director CDF, and George Gentry. So one of the superficial but annoying changes in the policy is we changed steelhead, that common term, to be anadromous rainbow trout, because that's actually the more correct common term. Or we can use the scientific name if you want to really be annoying. Then we updated the listing status. That was one of the very out-of-date portions of the policy. So you'll see in Table 1 where we have all the salmonids that are listed and both their federal and state listing status. We updated some of the direction to the departments. Specifically, there's been in Section 2A the reference to the importance of working landscapes to these salmonids. Also, reference to programmatic permitting, which we've heard a lot about this morning. And we added the reference to both the CDFs, the resources in Fish and Games, current efforts on landscape level planning and the programmatic permitting at the watershed scale. Right after Table 1, there is the T&I rules were referenced, and that was a suggestion by CDF that they be included. And then, let's see, in sections, well, actually throughout the whole strategy, but it starts in Section 2, we specifically referenced the coho recovery strategy and the steelhead restoration and management plan, because these are the documents that the state currently has that have specific actions to help deal with the recovery of these species. There's a reference also in Section 2E that we've been hearing a lot about this morning again, which is incorporating an information process that will incorporate whatever comes with the 2112s, timber harvest rules, 2081s, incidental take permits, some type of information packet that will satisfy all the agency requirements to help the working landscape owners. Some other significant changes were the reference to large woody debris removal. There is a significant issue, especially up on the North Coast. As you know, your timber practices require retention within the riparian zone, and these large trees then fall into the streams and become habitat, which is great, until somebody walks around at low water with a chainsaw and makes a Bigfoot or a dancing bear to sell. So we're very concerned about the retention of large woody debris in stream. So there are references to discouraging unauthorized removal. We also added language to acknowledge the other grant programs that deal with salmonids, the ones in the Central Valley, because this is a statewide joint policy. And deleted language that referenced specific programs that were extinct, the NICWAP, the North Coast Watershed Assessment Program, and Department's Watershed Academy. So that, very quickly, is an overview of some of the major updates and changes to the joint policy. If there's any questions on that. Pam.
Thank you, Gail, very much. I reviewed the policy, and there's a few little typos that I'll get to you. I do have a question on a couple of areas. One would be under 2B, where you reference in the last sentence 3, integrate and emphasize recovery of all anadromous species into recovery strategies and plans wherever possible. I'd like to insert the verbiage from E, where you, or those that may potentially be listed, or, you know, that verbiage that you have in E. And Gail and I have already actually visited about these items. A concern I would have in D is the last sentence, artificial production shall not be considered as appropriate mitigation for loss of wild fish or their habitat. As we know, this has been an ongoing issue, and, you know, I'm not sure that that's exactly the language that ought to be there.
That actually is the language from the old policy. It hasn't been changed.
I see that, yes. Yeah. And since this is the first time I've had an opportunity to speak on that point, I guess I'd like to suggest a change. I believe there was one other item. Oh, regarding in C, on the monitoring, does the department currently have their policy developed on how they're going to handle data distribution and protection of landowner private data?
Right. We have a draft policy that's still internal. It's been in process for about a year. And the crux of it is that we strive to protect landowner privacy issues, and that's achieved by taking the data and conglomerating it across the stream reach or whatever. It is still a draft policy.
Okay. And do you expect that to be finalized at some point? Or?
Yes, I've been getting a lot of emails on that lately.
Okay.
Yes,
great. Well, we look forward to seeing it. How's that?
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
I have a question in regard to you suggest a change in D with regard to artificial production, but what is your suggested change?
Well, we know that hatcheries have been in operation, and it's kind of an ongoing issue to help supplement populations, and I think we need to still wrestle with that. Wrestle with that. I know.
Okay.
I know.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Pam.
That's all. Thank you.
Mr. President.
Anyone?
Sure. I guess I have two questions. One is for this joint body as to how we proceed regarding this particular document before us, or is whether we're going to take action today or wait until we adjourn to our separate separate meetings and then have staff provide language back between the commission and the board. But I do have there's a couple of items, also some typos that I'd be happy to provide to you, Gail.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a couple significant things that should be added. At the top of page 3, the term of that is not a term of art, where it defines the protection and restoration of watersheds with threatened or impaired values. That's a very specific definition out of our regulations,
mm-hmm.
and I think it should to assist readers who are not who do not have our regulations at hand. We should add that contain listed anadromous salmonids and trout, because that is the definition of a threatened or impaired watershed. On page 4, the middle of the top paragraph, it talks about collecting land use data. It's not clear as to who would be responsible to collect those data, whether it would be done through FRAP or whether it would be done through through Fish and Games Organization, or how that would be handled.
It is purposefully unclear in terms of, we don't want to specify particular programs because programs do wax and wane.
Sure.
That direction is to both departments.
Okay. Also on page 7, at item, I believe it is now item D, the second complete paragraph. The last sentence, it talks about seek input from DFG where THPs are submitted, and it says four areas. I'd recommend that should read in planning watersheds, because that's the language that triggers this DFG review and consideration of timber harvesting plans. And I have some other minor edits I'll be happy to provide to you. I also have a general question that we're really talking about working with at least three different documents, or maybe four, the Steelhead report, the recovery, the coho recovery plan, which was approved by the Fish and Game Commission, the 2112, which is in only draft language at this point and has not yet been released, mm-hmm. and, of course, the Board of Forestry rules themselves, forest practice rules. I guess we really need to understand how we bring all those together. There's certainly things in the proposed 2112 regs, draft 2112 regs, that are not included in the COVID recovery strategy. So how do we blend all those four different documents and those different, some of which have regulatory authority, some of which don't at this time. Mm-hmm. How do we cohesively marry all of those documents together in seeking some clarification?
That's a very good question, and that was actually the reason behind. I'm trying to find the exact section. I think it's 2E. That the specific part of the policy that says something about a common informational and review process. Well, there's 2F that talks about the review process that'll satisfy a lot of what you've just stated.
But that section appears to be specific to the forest practice rules.
No, it also states it's
in the 2112s.
And 2112s.
But doesn't discuss at least at this section, the CO recovery plan or the Steelhead report.
No, the CO recovery plan in itself is a non-regulatory document.
But it was the document that provided direction to the department for the development of
the 2112s, right?
Exactly.
We can modify that further if you wish, but that was one of the goals of this, was to try and give direction to both departments to work together to come up with a common process.
Yeah. And that's just what I'm looking for, is consistency from the direction of the commission through the recovery plan to the 2112s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, go ahead. Try again.
I'm always on.
This one's on.
thanks, Gail. I think some of my questions, go to what Member Ray Nearson also touched upon. And it would seem to me that probably we have to bring back some of these proposed changes and deal with them in respectively in our commissions and authorize the chairs or the executive officers to work out the final words, because there's some – I don't want to take the group's time today, but there's some changes that I don't, you know, I'm not sure about, you noted the thing about woody debris. I'm not sure we should be discouraging it. I mean, if we have a rule against it, we should be doing something about it. But those kinds of things we can talk amongst ourselves and try mm-hmm. to sort out. I do think, can you tell me, I'm not familiar with what Fish and Game Code 2081 is.
I'm sorry, that's incidental take.
Okay,
provision.
So that's why the exception to incidental take in the
right.
policy. Okay, I understand that. And I think somewhere, and it's probably, I think, in the same area that Member Reinerson was noting, is I think there may be, it may be useful to put some other sentence in about the role of the T&I rules or their successors, however that may be, is an important piece of the puzzle. We note the adoption of them, but we don't mm-hmm. we don't have any action about it. So I think maybe our board can talk about that, and you all can talk about that, and our executive officers can sort out if that makes sense or not.
Right. I continue to look forward to working with George.
Great.
And
great.
John on this.
Thank you.
I have a question, and I raise it with some trepidation because it goes into the fish and game side. But in item 4, the specific policy from the board to the Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, item A reads, administer CDF programs consistent with this policy statement, which I think is a very appropriate catch-all statement. Yet when I look at the specific direction from the commission to the Department of Fish and Game, that statement is not there. I would just suggest that some consideration be given simply for the sake of congruency to adding that.
That sounds like a good recommendation and an easy one, too.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'd like to thank our respective staffs for working on this document. I think the changes reflect a positive direction forward, and I appreciate your efforts.
Any other questions or comments?
Going? Okay.
At some point, I'd like to ask CDF if they have some comments on this, and we do have some public comment. And
okay.
Get to that.
Want to do that now?
Sure. Yeah. Bill, the department have comments?
Thank you, Chairman Dixman. We have worked very closely with Gail and I think Chief Executive Officer Gentry looking at these pieces. I think from the department's perspective, we're very comfortable with the changes that have been made here. I think they'll move us forward into this next generation of planning relative to what to do about Coho. And I'm excited about getting a little more clarity that I think these changes bring to the process. I'm also, if anybody has any questions, I can certainly answer those from the department's perspective on this.
I don't see any red lights.
Thank you. How about if I add one?
Okay.
With
go
a
ahead.
Thought there. On some of the issues in here or some of the points brought up were in regard to assessment programs and additional programs. Is there funding that has been allocated for some of those and inventories? Watershed assessments. I know we, in the past, some of those programs were developed, but have not continued because of funding or other reasons. Are all the commitments in here doable? I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, I think Jim, in response to your question, is the direct funding. No, we have not had funding directly for some of these. We do have program funding supporting GIS. We do have program funding supporting staff. I think it'd be our job as managers to look at how best to utilize that funding and those functions and staff to assist in carrying out the policy. But I don't anticipate that there's a big bundle of funding out there that's going to come to us in addition to what we currently already have. And I think, as Banky pointed out so well, I think as we look at how to cooperatively approach these things, I think there are certain pieces and benefits we'll have out of working together that we currently don't enjoy. So I think we're going to deal with this internally. If funding comes our way, so much the better. But I do believe that we can and will move forward with this by redirecting staff and looking at how to make our efforts a little more compatible with the policy.
Well, the only point I guess I'm thinking of here is that rather than being very specific within our policy statement on what you're going to do without really having any assurance that it can be done, we may want to look at the structure of this policy statement to where it are some specific goals that then allow the departments, like you said, to manage their departments for those goals. And rather than specifically stating you will develop an inventory or whatever, that the goal might be to, develop the required information base to do a thorough review and leave it up to the departments to figure out how to do that. So it might be something to think about how this is actually structured so we can achieve it. And just provide so that it provides direction to the departments.
And I don't disagree, and I really viewed 2C as giving us quite a bit of flexibility in terms of how, from an department to department perspective, we approach that. But if there are other suggestions on how to word this, I think that was the intent, and I think we agree, Jim, with what you're saying here.
Mr. President. One other addition. I've got back through the pertinent section of the document. We heard during the report the current efforts underway to develop property-wide programs, programmatic EIRs, NCCPs, et cetera. I don't see anything in the document that specifically encourages long-term landscape-based planning documents. And I know I've heard Banky say that's where he'd like to see some of these solutions go. And certainly those are some of the efforts that landowners are currently working with. I think there's some great setups for it, but I think another sentence or two that both the board and the commission find that long-term planning documents, whether they're through SYPs, PTIRs, or other type arrangements that have not yet been developed,
would be beneficial towards the towards salmon.
And I agree, Gary, and I think as Gail pointed out, we attempted to capture that concept in the introduction on page one. Certainly, you know, it is our intent to look at programmatic approaches to the planning and land uses out there that will, I think, benefit our overall understanding of what those activities are planned to be and how those might affect salmonids and operate and implement those accordingly to protect both the working landscapes as well as the resources.
I would suggest we might consider additional language at 2C.
2C.
Maybe some little bit more specific language. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Bill then? We'll go to public comment and have the executive officer read off the names of those that have requested time.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, the first speaker is Craig Bell.
Yes, members of the board, members of the commission, my name is Craig Bell, and I have a long history in this field. I have a former commercial fisherman, former logger, currently licensed fishing guide for 20 some years, and was put out of business by Klamath regulations back in the 80s and early 90s, so I go back to that. And just to give a little brief history of on the coho issue, it's now been 12 years since commercial fishermen have been able to harvest a single coho, and it's now been 10 years since sport fishermen have been able to harvest a single coho. And we have watersheds, for example, such as the Eel, that was once the third, one of the top three producers of salmon and steelhead in the state, now have zero harvest of salmon or steelhead in the 1,000 square mile watershed. So I'm here basically to say extend the T&I rules and move to adopt the 21-12 rules in a timely manner. I have concerns about the appearance of efforts to reduce riparian standards as a motive for review of the T&I rules. And I'm hearing talk, people are saying, well, shade is not as important as people think. And I would say on some level I indeed agree that buffers probably need to be improved to decrease relative air temperature and increase relative humidity, which play an equal or larger role in reducing stream temperatures. And to have coho salmon back, you really need to use the phrase restoration of the cold water fishery. You always need to keep that in your mind, restoration of the cold water fishery. They are the most dependent on cold temperature. They are the most fragile of our salmonids, and in considering protection measures, that phrase needs to be in your mind, protection of the cold water fisheries. And where did this cold water come from that was and is so important for coho salmon? And how is it going to be returned? Because that will be the key to coho salmon. If you plant salmon, hatchery salmon, in water that has an average temperature of over 68 degrees, they will vanish from that system. You'll be wasting your time. And I would say that the concerning data management, there is some language. I sat on the coho recovery team and worked for the Salmon and Steelhead Recovery Coalition, which were petitioners, and have worked for a number of fishery environmental groups over the years, although I've stepped aside from that to move just into restoration work now. Data language, specific data sharing language was worked out in the coho recovery plan and exists there, and I think that could be used to address data sharing concerns. And lastly, I think that the literature does support the T&I rules as well as the 2112, and I think the Department of Fish and Game does support the T&I rules, and National Marine Fisheries Service certainly promotes continuation of at least as a floor the T&I rules, and in the process we were assured that the T&I rules would be the floor. And I can say that if the Board of Forestry does not protect state and protect water quality and restoration of the cold water fishery, state and regional water board has and will continue to step in to assert their authority because it is their ultimate authority. Thank you very much.
The next speaker is Paul Mason.
Morning, members of the board, members of the commission. It's a full room this morning. So Paul Mason with Sierra Club California. And I just have a few comments on the joint policy here, starting with Section D on page 4. I think the first couple of sentences there are just fine, but I question the addition to the third sentence, the board and commission shall approve any project upon a joint finding. I'm unclear why that needs to be a joint finding as opposed to being the responsibility of the Department of Fish and Game to be evaluating the impact of a project on a listed species. And I'd hate to see the clear authority of the department get muddled by requiring another agency which does not, frankly, have the expertise. You know, I love my friends at the department, but they're not riddled with biologists over there. So I'd like to make sure that remains very clearly the department's responsibility there. Further in that sentence, I'm also unclear. It says, we'll oppose any project which will result in the irreplaceable loss of fish, the net loss of fish habitat, and or impede the recovery of populations in habitat. It seems that causing unauthorized take would also be a relevant standard to have in there someplace. I realize that the standard for take under CESA is squishy at best, but it is, of course, a legal standard that should probably be included there someplace. And I would have to respectfully disagree with my with Board Member Jack Meany about the last clause there, that artificial production of salmonids cannot be considered a mitigation. You cannot damage the habitat, damage the population, and simply plant more artificial fish as the mitigation. That just enables a cycle where you end up having nothing but hatcheries and have lost all of your meaningful habitat. My other comments are in Section F, and I would agree with my colleague, Mr. Reinerson, that it makes sense to include the recovery plan there as well. But I wonder if there's any logical reason why we haven't addressed any of the federal requirements as well under the Federal Endangered Species Act, because, of course, you refer back to earlier in the document, there's a whole host of federally listed salmonid species that the only meaningful way they're going to get any regulatory protection is through the state permitting process. And to the extent that we may have a 4D rule at some point, it seems that we should be trying to collect that information and acknowledging that there is going to be a federal nexus here as well at some point. So I suggest that that might be beneficial to include that. And finally, jumping to, I guess this is a specific policy for CDF on page 7, under Section D there, where it talks about thoroughly consider potential impacts to coho salmon in the THP review process. And it seems to me that considering impacts is not really the same as avoiding take or, you know, allowing for recovery or any of those other standards. I'm not sure what considering impacts really means when it comes right down to it. But thank you for your time.
The next speaker is Jeff Shelato.
Good morning, board and commission members. My name is Jeff Shelato. I'm the government affairs manager for Caltrout. And I wanted to echo the sentiments that Craig Bell expressed a minute ago, that Caltrout was a participant in the coho recovery strategy and thinks that the T&I rules need to be renewed without delay. They're the foundation that plan was built upon. We also think that there needs to make this joint policy have some meaning, that the department needs to start moving on the adoption of the 2112 regulations. It's been now 2 years since the commission adopted that strategy. It's going on 2 years since the commission adopted the listing, and I think 2 years is long enough, and it needs to go beyond the informal process, and a timetable needs to be developed and a schedule that starts the process for getting those 2112s in place. It's, you know, as Craig said, it's fundamentally unfair that all fishing, both commercial and recreational, has been banned for more than 10 years, and in some respects, some of the underlying causes have still not been addressed, causing the decline in the species. Now, on the non-regulatory front, I'm glad to see that the policy proposes or endorses a continuation of what's been called the SB 271 process. This is the ongoing funding to address some of the habitat problems that have been characterized as legacy problems. Caltrout's working with 11 other environmental groups on legislation in Sacramento to renew this law that allocates in $8 million a year in Thailand oil revenues for salmon and steelhead restoration. That was authored under a bill that's now Congressman, former Senator Mike Thompson authored in 1997. That law is expiring this year. Caltrot tried to get that law extended last year under a bill carried by Senator Carol Migdon. It got vetoed, unfortunately. This year, we're working with a number of other environmental groups to bring that bill back. There's been a great increase in the Thailand oil revenues. Last year's budget was assuming $35 per barrel oil. January budget said it was up to 55. You all know it's more like 75 now. It's created a $180 million windfall in Thailand oil revenues to the state. And we're working with Senator Chesbrough on SB 1125. 11 groups, this bill would provide $30 million to deal with fishing game structural problems in marine resources and non-game, as well as $10 million a year for salmon and steelhead restoration. We're hoping to have this adopted as a budget trailer bill. And it would be great if the commission or the board could throw its weight behind that. This addresses the non-regulatory scheme in this area, and I think there's strong support within a lot of these projects for salmon steelhead restoration or on private land. And so I wanted to just let you know we're working on things besides the regulatory arena, and it would be great if you could all support that. Thank you.
The next speaker is Richard Ginger. Do you want to defer, Richard?
My name is Richard Ginger, Commission, Board, Chair, and President. I'd like to reserve the ability to give some input after the presentation about the coho recovery strategy as well. I have a few points about the policy I wanted to bring up. On page 3, under 2B, I think it's important to include the SRP report, the Scientific Review Panel report, which was in a way the foundation for the threatened or impaired rules. But one thing that's not being addressed, we've sort of gotten at a little bit by Gary, and the concern for programmatic approaches is one of the main conclusions of the SRP report was that the weakest part of the forest practice rules in terms of risk to salmon was an inadequate cumulative impacts process. And remind you, too, that the recovery strategy tried to address that. But I think that needs to be addressed in your joint policy. And on the same page, under C, it's got deleted and other plans developed to restore salmon, anadromous trout, and watersheds. I don't think it would hurt to add that because there's different programs, including some of these programmatic projects like the Matol and the two MRCs, PTERs, that are other plans being developed that I think it's important for both bodies to support. I guess there's a couple of grammatical things. On page 4, also, but on page 4 under F, under information requirements, develop a timber harvest plan format review process that will satisfy the information requirements. One particular pet peeve of mine is we got rules changes to require foresters to evaluate and map spawning and rearing habitat, but oftentimes the implementation of that doesn't really give you adequate information, which it should, about the location and mapping and evaluation of spawning and rearing habitat. I guess that's enough comments on the joint policy right now. I refer you to the letter that you were given today. In this letter, speaking on behalf of Humboldt Watershed Council, the Salmon and Steelhead Recovery Coalition, Environmental Protection Information Center, one of the things I want to emphasize here, and I've talked about this with a number of people today and previous, it involves both the reevaluation of the threatened and impaired rules, the scientific backing, but it goes beyond that. I think you need to have not only representation that's supported by the higher-ups in both the administration and the legislature, of all the different agencies involved with this to give oversight to this review process and also be a clearinghouse or a body that can act on these things that we talk about these cooperative endeavors so that people stay on track You know, it's a very complicated scenario, and unless you have some kind of a regular organized body to address this, things just dissipate. Hope to speak to your lawyer. Thank you.
The next speaker is Jody Fradiani.
Thank you, commissioners, members of the board. My name is Jody Frediani. I represent Sierra Club, Ventana Chapter, and Citizens for Responsible Forest Management. And I'd just like to say that I second all of the comments made by the previous speakers. And we heard that over the last 12 years, the fishing community has not been able to fish for coho in the Central Coast. The coho salmon have not only not recovered, but they have recently been upgraded in the listing to endangered from threatened on the federal level. So they're not doing well. As far as just a couple of very specific comments, Board Member Reinerson had mentioned under the sort of an explanation on the new section about threatened or impaired values having to do with listed fish. I'd also like to suggest that if that takes place, that the impaired has to do with 303 delisted water bodies and for impairment, so that clarification could be added as well. And that's on page 3. And on page 7, D, where the language has been changed pretty seriously, it now says thoroughly consider potential impacts to coho salmon in the THP review process. Et cetera. I agree with Paul Mason on that consideration is just a very vague, unclear word. But I also don't understand why anadromous trout have been left out of that equation. Certainly, they're listed species. They should be included in there just as much as the coho. Thank you.
The next speaker will be Addie Jacobson.
Good morning, board members and commission members. I just wanted to address something that no one's brought up, and perhaps it isn't a problem for you, but at the top of page 6, number E, on the talk of if they're in the event of disagreement, I just am a little concerned that all this statement does is acknowledge that there's a problem, and we all know that acknowledging you have a problem is a good first step, but it is a first step. And, you know, I'm not sure if you wouldn't want to look at this in terms of what do you do when there is a disagreement. Now you know you've got a problem, but is there a process? Because conflict resolution is sometimes better served if you have your process in place before you have the problem. So I'm just bringing that up, and it's up to you to decide what you want to do with it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, that concludes those that have signed up to speak on this topic.
Well, I think having heard the comments from Board of Forestry members that the process is going to require, at least for our board, that this issue go back before our Forest Practice Committee. That could ostensibly happen tomorrow, and our board could possibly take an action. Mm-hmm. on this policy on Thursday when the board meets in regular session. I'm not totally optimistic.
Yeah, I was going to say that's pretty optimistic.
It's going to happen, but it could happen. Yeah. I would like, at least for our board, to suggest that it have priority. If it doesn't happen at this meeting, that we set the June meeting as a date for adoption, so we can get it back to whatever we would adopt back to your commission and see how it sails there.
I agree. I think we should send it back to our respective staffs and committees, as you mentioned, and have them work on it and then bring it back for us. In terms of, I don't know if we have to go and relist with the additional changes, or
what our process is in terms of coming to final adoption. I mean, notice, not list, but go notice on it.
We would. It's not a regulatory change.
Okay.
It's a policy adoption.
Okay.
We would advise that to have the document ahead of time so that commissioners would have the chance to review it before adoption is scheduled, so that everyone is in agreement with any future amendments.
Okay. Very good. We can shoot for June as well, provided our staffs get together and work out these issues.
You had a comment?
I tried to have a comment.
Just one other in order, so I'm sure the Fish and Game Commission doesn't fall into the black holes that ours does, but it may also make sense for the respective commission to designate, one or two members so that when the staff have worked it out, if there's still differences, you all may take one tack, we may take another tack, the staff is not really sure, maybe we can at least come out of our respective meetings tomorrow with one or more members that are designated to sort and sift language. So when we actually notice it the next time, at least to the extent this is knowable, we actually have documents that we're both apt to actually adopt whenever we can do it, whether that's next month or the following month. Otherwise, I'm afraid we'll get into a do loop that we'll each do something. The staffs will try to resolve it. We won't really finish it.
We can do it concurrently. So
yeah.
Might I suggest that at the conclusion of the meetings this week, and executive staff is in very close proximity to one another, we can meet at the beginning of next week to compare the documents and any amendments that were proposed, and then get those out to both commission and board members to be scheduled at the next meeting.
Works.
Is that a good game plan?
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. You have the next item?
Let's see. We'll move back then to item 6.
You want to discuss the COLA strategy?
I think.
Yeah.
Did we miss something, Gail? I guess we did.
A. Go ahead, Gail. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Yes, we're going to go back to the COLA recovery strategy report, was the concept. Once again, I'm Gail Newton, Fisheries Branch, Fish and Game, and team leader for the COA recovery strategy. First of all, let me acknowledge some of our team members that are here today. Michelle Diaz, that just walked in from CFA, and her alternate, Peter Rebar. There's Craig Bells, Sierra Club, and his alternate, Richard. Dwayne Chitaku for CDF. Pam Giacometti, Emeritus. No longer serving, and Charlotte Ambrose from NOAA Fisheries. I think that's everyone here today. We met on March 28th in Santa Rosa, largely to the kindness of Sonoma County Water Agency that provided the funding for the facilitation and support of the meeting. The members shared information on the progress of implementation of the recovery strategy. And from the department perspective, one method that we've taken to implement it is to give an extra point for a fisheries restoration grant program for those proposals that will address a high priority task in a high priority watershed. And using that strategy, about 13% of our projects that were funded last year did just that. We had previously organized some ad hoc committees as part of the recovery team to deal with some of the large, range-wide, overarching issues. They hadn't met till fairly recently, so we kind of pushed that along. And there was some progress made on some of these committees. The ones that did make progress was LWD theft, large woody debris theft. Implementing one of the recommendations in the recovery strategy was to try and work on policies for the departments with regard to large woody debris theft, and that's why you see that in your joint policy. That is actually implementation of the COHO recovery strategy. That committee is also looking into what authorities can be used to maintain that wood in stream. Large woody debris management was another ad hoc committee. This is largely looking at banking or programmatic solutions because sometimes wood in the stream impacts things such as bridges and other infrastructure, and it has to be removed. But it can be stockpiled and then replaced or used for other projects. We don't want to lose that resource, that large wood. So members that are on the team, which includes Caltrans as well as some counties, are looking at ways to bank, manage, and programmatically permit large woody debris. There's also another group that's dealing with programmatic permits, which we've heard a lot about this morning. And they're just barely getting started. But what a lot of people are looking to is we maintain programmatic permits on our fisheries restoration grant program. We're the only grant program in the state that does this. That means that my staff spend a lot of time in CEQA Health, but we maintain a regional general permit through the Corps. We maintain a 401 permit with the State Board, which is a lot of room for improvement with that that interaction. We maintain, through the Corps permit, we also maintain our permits with NOAA Fisheries and the Fish and Game permit. So it is a showcase for how you can do programmatic permitting. But it is very intensive, labor intensive, and requires a lot of monitoring and implementation and staff time. So we are using that as a basis to look at programmatic permitting for groups of activities in the strategy. And there's also an ad hoc committee on land management and conversion. And they're trying to look at incentive-based methodologies to minimize ag land conversion and timberland conversion, as our large working landscapes are some of our best habitat that remain. The other thing we went through this meeting in March is, as I think some of you experienced, I know Pam did, developing this recovery strategy and what was an 18 to 12 month process meant that it isn't perfect and there are some holes and it has need for improvement. It will always, it's a working document, a live document. And pursuant to that, there's a section in the recovery strategy in section 12.12 that while Fish and Game Code is silent with regard to updating the strategy, the Coho recovery strategy, which you adopted, commissioners, has a section in there about how we will continue to go back to the recovery team with proposed modifications and updates to recommendations. So we did make some, the department made some suggested changes to the recommendations. But we're trying to do this in a fiscally responsible manner, so largely via email. And that's been a little bit problematic. And as of yesterday, I'd only received votes on the proposed recommendations from 8 of our 20 voting members. And so I really don't have anything to bring forth at this time. I need to work out the voting procedures a little bit better so we get a better response. We also, because we are doing it via email, it makes the dialogue that's often necessary to come to consensus on specific language a little bit more difficult. One other thing that I want to talk to you about that is highlighted in the recovery strategy, and that is, and you've also heard about with crossings and road issues and all that this morning, is fish passage. And the recovery strategy addresses fish passage independently. It puts forth some tasks in various watersheds where fish passage is a very important issue. It also recognizes the fish passage forum, which is a public, private, multi-agency, federal, county forum, where we try and deal with fish passage issues throughout the state. And so I've given you this morning, actually you asked for this last year. I talked to you about the fish passage form last year, and you'd asked for some information because we do, through our fisheries restoration grant program, we fund our fish passage, the PAD assessment database, and that's the summary sheet that I passed out during the break. It's very coast-o-centric. We haven't gotten the information for the Central Valley. We have spots, but not enough to really display here. Anyways, just looking at the coast areas, you can see that we've identified almost 12,000 barriers currently. And this also, if you look at some of the bar graphs on the right, it gives you an idea of which ones are the high priority. We have over 500 of those, and how many have been mediated to some degree. And there's 667 of those over the last few years. So we are working on the fish passage issue. And the other trinket is this DVD that I gave each of you a copy of. They're out of print right now. We're getting another 1,000 printed. This is a cooperative product through the fish passage forum, largely with Fish and Game funds and NOAA funds. and Pacific States Marine Fishery Council funds and staff. And this is a really interesting video to watch. I recommend you all do. It's got about 20 minutes looking at the issues of fish passage and what you need to do to remediate, and it gives a case study that's in a fast-forward mode, so it doesn't take that long. But it's a very good video to watch, so I've provided each with a copy. If you need more, let me know. It'll be probably another month or two before we get any more, but let me know, and I'll try and get them to you. So with that, that's the update on the Coho Recovery Team meeting and what's going on with the strategy, if there's any questions. And we miss you, Pam.
Richard Garner again, Commission and Board, President and Chairman. Just a few comments. I have here only one copy with me of the timber management measures adopted in February 2004. Maybe if it works out, I could get copies for you later. The first 10 sections that were adopted by the Commission were the landowner recommendations, and then there were sections 11, 17 added by the department, and then after that there was a couple more appended to it. They're very key, and they repeat a lot of the issues that were brought up about cumulative impacts, about programmatic processes, working together, adequate documentation, monitoring, and all that, and those are really good things. One of the things that the recovery strategy hits on that's Section 12, part of what was added by Fish and Game and approved by the Commission, was to acquire conservation easements or land in fee title from willing landowners to protect coho salmon habitat. And this, I guess, has been a little bit of an issue with these recommendations that have been brought forward, because for the Eel River, that language was said to be not in line with the overall coho strategy. But apparently language that was used in the Matoll, seek opportunities for landscape conservation, that's okay. So in my capacity of sent an email saying that, well, if they have a problem with seeking conservation easements or fee title from willing sellers only for protection of coho, and that's a problem, well, just substitute the Matoll language, but apparently is not a problem. I think a lot of these things need to be, you know, not shuffled under the carpet. In talking briefly with Resource Secretary Chrisman outside, I cited the Coho Recovery Team as perhaps a building block in this blue ribbon or oversight panel to make recommendations on issues. That trying to get that kind of a broad representation has been really an excellent experience, and I think has meant a lot for the state in trying to deal with some on it issues. So I'd encourage a similar or expanded recovery team concept be taken on by you all. Thank you.
Okay, no questions or comments? All right.
I'd like to address
did you want to summarize?
Comment?
Okay. Go right ahead.
What Richard's referring to is there was recommendations put forth asking for acquisition language to be added to the strategy. Oh, good, I'm done. And some of the other co-recovery team members can speak to this, and actually Pam might be a good one if you want to, which is during the development of the strategy, we tried to do it as basically as a consensus process. And acquisition was against the policy of some of the landowner groups, and therefore it would not make a consensus agreement. So the way that we represented this in the document was we retained acquisition or conservation easements at the range-wide scale as a tool in our toolbox that we can use where appropriate with willing sellers, willing landowners. But we did not give it specifically at a watershed scale where it would actually be of major concern for certain landowners. So it is a tool in the toolbox. It is one that people use. department definitely uses, but it is not represented at the watershed scale, which is what Richard is suggesting. And that was some of the recommendations that were put forward. And the votes that we've gotten so far, we have some significant no votes on those recommendations where acquisition was included.
Okay. Thank you. No, no rebuttal. We get the rebuttal. Did you want to make any comments, ma'am?
Yes, I'm getting the high sign that I need to make a comment. And Gail is right on, and that's exactly why it was set up that way, range-wide versus specific watershed. We didn't want something targeting or making certain landowners feel like they were targeted. So thank you, Gail.
Thank you. Thank you, Gail. We're going to take a 10-minute break and then come back with item number 6.
Well, that was 8, so let's try 6. Report of the departments regarding implementation of joint policy on pre, during, and post-fire activities in wildlife habitat, and a discussion of the statewide MOU for fire safe clearance for wildlife. And I would ask Chris Simney from the board staff to give us an overview of where we're headed with this. Chris?
Good morning, board members, commission members. Chris Simney, I'm a regulations coordinator for the Department of Forestry and Fire Protection and board staff member. I'll be referring to a document in your packets, board members, an item 6, tab 6 of your blue binder. And commission members, it's a document titled Draft Proposal April 21st, 2006 is the first title block on it. And members of the public, if you'd like, if anyone doesn't have a copy, anyone like to have one, I have some extra ones here to talk off. So feel free, if you like it, and let me give one to Secretary Christman sitting there. And thank you. There's some extra ones too. What I'd like to just briefly go over today is not so much the board and commission's fire policy that we recognize needs some updating, but a topic that may be relevant to the update of the fire policy, and also in the spirit of our joint cooperation between the boards and commissions and departments to provide some regulatory relief. What this is in the short answer is a memorandum of understanding to address wildlife protection and endangered species listings relative to some of the hazard reduction requirements that are in law and mandated for defensible space around homes. Again, when I say defensible space, I'm talking about some of the Department of Forestry's regulations and the board's regulations for clearing 100 feet around a structure for fire-safe hazard reduction around homes. And what I have before you on this proposal, you'll see I just want to introduce this as an initial topic that hopefully upon our board and commission direction we can jointly discuss in the future, but I just wanted to introduce it today. You'll see that the wildlife proposal addresses a memorandum of understanding between the Fish and Wildlife and Department of Fish and Game and Department of Forestry, and it's very, very specific and a lot of detail in it. And that's because this memorandum of understanding is already in effect for the county, entire county of San Diego, and has been in effect since 1997. So we know that this concept is operational and feasible, and we wanted to discuss this as a possible document for statewide use or regional use or upon some direction from our board members how we might like to implement it. I'm just going to briefly go over what exactly this document is. It was brought to our attention by board member Nehring during our recent board hearings for developing a defensible space guidelines. We recognized, board member Nehring recognized in San Diego County that there had been ongoing conflicts between two conflicting laws. One that, in essence, protects wildlife in multi-species conservation planning areas, and a law from the fire departments that said you need to clear and do some vegetation modification around your home. As they found in San Diego County, and as we heard from the public last month at our regular board meeting in San Diego, They went about and created an arrangement amongst the their wildlife agencies and the forestry fire protection departments to address this issue of the landowner stuck in the middle. He is supposed to do his fire protection clearing, but on the other hand, there are laws and other requirements that would restrict him from doing that piece of work. So what they did in this compact, in this memorandum of understanding, was try to help account for avoiding potential adverse impacts of sensitive species while still getting the hazard abatement activities done. And in this outline, if you would look on page 2, you will see one of the, under section 1 at the bottom there, one of the general bottom line components of this MOU is that for certain hazard reduction activities, the MOU authorizes a take of species listed as endangered and species or candidate under specific provisions of the Fish and Game Code. And again, in San Diego County, this is an edited version from that. We took out the San Diego County specifics, but if I had the San Diego County provision with me, you would see that they identified very specific species and named them by name as this would be adhering to. Some of the other components of the MOU are to address, for example, on page 3 and page 4, the type of activities to which this memorandum of understanding would be applicable to. In the one in San Diego County, you can see that they talked about the 30 and 100-foot clearing around a building. There's recent laws that have just come in, been enrolled, that talk about 300 feet around certain infrastructure facilities such as hospitals and evacuation and shelter areas. Also talks about the clearing. Such clearing would be exempt or provided a take permit for improved and unimproved property, which is far beyond what the board, our Board of Forestry, has adopted guidelines and regulations for, which has been primarily for hazard reduction around structures. One of the key components of the memorandum of understanding is the relationship of notification by wildlife agencies to a person regarding an endangered species issue. And if you notice on page 5, under section 3, under notification of landowners, I'll summarize by saying that when an agency notifies a landowner that there is an endangered species issue, that there would be suggested ways to mitigate the impact of that and voluntarily develop with the landowner alternate abatement measures feasible and warranted. And there's some discussion about that the landowner needs to provide affirmative response to that within a set 10-day period. So it's a rather progressive regulatory streamlining, in a sense, or marrying up, harmonizing of conflicting laws that are out there and that the individual landowner has to deal with. The memorandum additionally talks about biological opinions that were needed to address such an agreement. And I just would like to close with saying that we know that the issues in San Diego County are as complex as anywhere, with NCCP areas and multi-species conservation areas. And it seems to have been a very effective tool, we heard, from the fire safe councils. I have spoken to the County Planning Commission, who has a multi-species conservation plan program there, and they seem to be happy with it. We know the City of San Diego is adopting similar ordinances and compacts similar to this. And so I just would like to bring to the board and commission's members that this would be another opportunity for us to work cooperatively in the future with our respective staffs upon direction from the commission and the board to see if this is reasonable and try to put the terms in for statewide or regional or whatever the appropriate geographic location is. So thank you. That's what I wanted to do in my initial comments.
Thank you, Chris. Board of Forestry members have questions, comments? Ron? And then Pam.
First, I wanted to say thank you to everyone and the chairman and members of the board for coming back down to San Diego for the second board meeting since the Cedar Fire. I know that speaking to some of the community leaders who participated in some of the meetings and discussions, they very much appreciated having the board back down there. And I was glad that we could see the state of recovery in the areas that were affected specifically by the Cedar Fire and such. One thing that I wanted to comment on, and I always want to stress this point, and that is that we can create all the great and effective and proper and legal rules and regulations and guidelines and so on and so forth, but unless that information gets down to the end user, to the property owner, to the casual property owner, not the person who comes to these meetings or watches on the web or the like. I mean, we by definition are not normal. Those of us in this room, we're not normal, as evidenced by the fact that we're in here and not outside looking at the lake, and we deliberately chose to have the blinds closed rather than open. I mean, clearly we are not normal, so we need to ensure that our communications are not just geared to people like us, to people who are either paid to be here or our board members and such, but we need to make sure that we have communications so that the casual property owner knows what they need to do in order to be safe, and that they understand in an easily digestible way, what the rules and regulations are and how those various conflicts are involved. Otherwise, we're going to get in a situation where we were in now, where you have a tremendous amount of frustration due to a lack of knowledge. And in my time on the board, I've seen a lot of good PR materials that have come toward me because I'm a member of this board, and the great materials, which of course I apply immediately and made sure that I did all my clearing before I had the Board of Forestry come to my house. That could have been a problem, but nevertheless, most people are not on the Board of Forestry, and therefore we have to be sure that those materials are getting out to property owners, not just through the fire safe councils, because I think your casual property owner is not a member of a fire safe council. Does even know what a fire safe council is? So we have to continue to look for that, and I hope that we continue to do that. And once we finalize the various regulations that we're looking at and the like, that we get to the point where we're actually engaged in a marketing effort using leveraging whatever partners whoever we can partner up with, so that the end user is ultimately protected, or else this information is it will be a very nice theoretical exercise, but won't ultimately protect lives and property to the extent that they could. And my only other question is, why do the members of the commission get much cooler name tags than we do? What's with this? I mean, gee whiz. I want to be on that commission.
9 of you, and it costs more.
Anyhow, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ryan. Pam?
Thank you, Stan. Chris, I appreciate you bringing this forward. One thing I notice is there an opportunity here to address maybe fuels management on state-owned lands? We do mention federal lands. We don't mention state lands, and I would suggest that maybe that is a topic for discussion in here. Thank you.
I appreciate that, Member Giacomini. I know that this is, again, in concept, and I hope that we begin our initial talks in on all the topics that need to be included from a statewide perspective.
If I may, question for you. Down in the Santa Barbara area, I found out last week that some monies had been given to the local fire agencies for there were additional monies, and I don't know what the mechanism was, and I didn't take the time to find out. But they were doing things like building new fire stations and buying homes for because you can't live in Santa Barbara if you're a regular person. You live someplace where you get to mess with the freeway. But there is street after street after street that you drive down in Santa Barbara and in Montecito, for example, where you have canopy closure over the top. And you can just see one of these sundowner crown fires coming through there and just wiping out the whole joint. And I'm wondering how much cooperation, because the local homeowners, clearly they often bitch and moan about the fire agencies coming in because they say, well, I want to live in a forest. I want to live in this wonderful green environment. How much how much interaction is there now between CDF and the local agencies to really put the heat on these guys to that's a bad pun, to do something about this? Because you literally, it is spooky during the fire season to drive some of the streets, a lot of the streets in the Santa Barbara area, where you have total canopy closure.
I'd just like to address a couple comments on that in terms of both the level of inspection and compliance that local and CDF fire departments do, and also the prescription that you're talking about with the continuous canopy. If I could just address the prescription for a moment. The board recently adopted regulations for how homeowners in state responsibility area should do their clearing. And one of the factors that we found in our technical review research was that we know people, one, like to have their trees in place. And a big factor was how can we reduce the impact of your average severe fire from hitting the crowns and causing a catastrophic fire? One of the options that the board has adopted for vegetation treatment is to allow people to leave their large trees, limb them up, and substantially reduce what we call the ladder and surface fuels that would lead your average crown fire, your average fire into the crowns and impact significant problems. So in a balance of trying to maintain habitat and aesthetics, the board adopted that based on some science review. Obviously, in the most catastrophic wind-driven situation of Southern California, it's hard to imagine anything is going to be able to be resistant enough.
Yeah, that's really true. I mean, vertical continuity is what you want to break up, but often the fire starts in a structure. And, you know, a lot of these structures have oaks and whatever, or worse, eucalyptus, literally all over the house.
Yeah. Certainly part of the clearing requirement that the state has for the 0 to 30-foot area away from a home is a far more intensive review, a far more intensive clearing requirement where branches over certain parts of the house are addressed. On the second point, though, of how intensively are these applied, we know that from the board's experience, and at least my perspective, and over the last year with the board talking about these guidelines, we know that there is some places where there's good compliance and some places where there's not. And I think just through hearsay, places in Los Angeles County, for example, have excellent compliance. We know that the department, and I'm sure Chief Mitchell might want to mention this also too, is that recent augmentation for additional people for the non-fire season for year-round staffing is going to be a great asset for focusing on additional compliance for this hazard reduction around homes. I know the department is also working on training programs for its own inspectors and eventually certification programs for members of the public to help understand what exactly these clearing requirements are. And I think finally they're also the Department of Forestry and Fire Protection is contemplating automated inspection programs where reporting and monitoring and performance evaluations can be made.
Are the insurance companies playing any role in this now? I mean, clearly the insurance companies have a stake in this thing, and you can't get a loan on a house, obviously, without fire insurance. And isn't there some way to get a little leverage going in that direction so that CDF, or the local fire agency, if it didn't certify the standoff distances from the home, I'm sorry, you don't get your insurance certificate.
I'm not completely familiar with the insurance company's obligations. We know, though, that it was brought to the board's attention that the insurance company obligations on persons in a mapped high hazard area are really extreme sometimes, to the point of we need a 1,000-foot clearing around one's house. I'm exaggerating. Obviously, one's property boundary would never extend that far, and so what control do they have? And I'm not sure what the remedy or the result was from the insurance company, whether it was increased premiums or no premiums, or one had to go to that quasi-state-sponsored fair plan. But we know that they're part of the solution and encouraging people to get that work done.
Gary?
Thanks, Chris. Chris, how good of job have we done educating the counties and the local entities regarding the 4291 standards? The Board of Forestry developed regulations, recommendations for implementation of this law two meetings ago. And this law has been in effect since January of 2005, correct?
Yeah.
And it also, and these regulations preempt local, city, and county ordinances, correct? These are state standards within
SRA. If they're
SRA.
Lesser, of a lesser standard, yeah.
Right. And if they're within SRA.
Right.
And I guess I have concerns, especially whereas the county would be would typically be the entity that would be implementing these, that we done a good job informing all the counties that these standards are now in place and you know, are required.
I would characterize it as ongoing. Certainly, Chief Mitchell and his staff has been working on that, getting the message to our own department members initially on what exactly these standards are, so that we have a clear and consistent message going out. And I know that as now the rule is adopted and will be finalized by OAL anytime, we expect a vigorous rollout to all the stakeholders at the department at the unit level interfaces, because that's where the connection has been made and will continue to be made in terms of communicating to people is at a unit by unit level.
David?
Chris, I'd like to compliment you on this initiative. I think it's a very good idea that will facilitate the vegetation clearance for fire protection purposes. I have a clarification question. On page 2, a provision you referred to, section 1, the sentence says that the MOU authorizes take of species listed under the state law only. Then if you turn to page 7, under the special terms and conditions, there is a reference or a statement that it is understood by the parties that the service, that's the Fish and Wildlife Service, authorizes incidental take of federally listed species. I think it would help if those provisions were made congruent. My guess is from reading this that the service will authorize take through the issuance of a biological opinion referred to on page 7. So I'm not asking for your response now, but I think that should all be clarified, and I hope you would go back to the service and work with them on that language.
Yeah, if directed so by the board, certainly. And, again, any editing we made to make this look holistic from a statewide perspective may have lost some of the nuances on exactly what they have in San Diego County, but certainly it was a federal, at least just by the mere title, a federal and state effort.
Jim?
Chris, in the same area there, I have kind of similar question to Member Nowies. But so this in San Diego County did apply to federal and state listed species?
I believe that was the case, yes.
And is there any differences in the definitions of take between the two acts? Which maybe that's a...
Yeah, board members. I'm not sure, and that's obviously the type of questions that we want to make sure we smooth out as we get through these.
Well, and then the other question on, statewide necessity for this kind of an agreement is are endangered species inhibiting the application of fire clearance rules statewide, or is it just specifically, portions of the state or certain species? This is seems like a pretty blanket proposal, which may be appropriate, but I just wondered how complex of a process it would be to actually do this statewide.
I certainly think that's the locations where the complexities are. Certainly Southern California, where their designated habitat areas was the precursor for all of this, because they did run into problems how many issues there were, how many violations were brought up. I don't have details on that.
Any other board member questions? I don't know about commissioners, if they're had a chance to even review this policy. So you're what, Chris, anticipating that at least from the board standpoint, this get referred to Resource Protection Committee for further?
That would be my suggestion, Chairman, is that if collectively from this meeting there's some interest in following through on the details and nuances of this, that we remand it to board committee, as we always do, work with Marty Burback from the department and find the other appropriate representatives, probably federal in this case, to work with us and agendize it as an ongoing activity.
Member Bassetti, you think that would fit in your committee as a
Yeah, I think it would, Chairman Dixon, along with kind of a review of this joint policy on pre, during, and post-fire activities. I noticed that one was dated 1994, and in the glance I've had of it, there's some things in there that probably need to be refined.
Okay. Any other board comment on this then? I think we have a couple of public comment.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, no, it's just a point of clarification for your anticipation of this document. I understand this originated in San Diego County that has a habitat conservation plan / natural communities conservation plan. So extensive work and commitment has been made to protection of wildlife corridors and endangered species that addresses both state and federal law with incidental take permits. I don't want to give the impression that has a standard of investment, both in conservation and in planning, that is, and incidental take permits that were easier to build off this. We wouldn't be in conflict with the Fire Safe Council recommendations. But not every place in California has an NCCP or HCP joint take authority by the federal and state government. So I'm sure my partners from National Marine Fisheries Service, as we got into listed species habitats, would want to participate. And this was done because of the catastrophic nature of fires and the reality that you can protect a tenth of an acre today with all your might, only to have 10,000 acres destroyed. And that was, in fact, the issue. So just a little temperance in terms of how to do this so that people have, especially the fire chiefs and the folks who are trying to make this work on the ground, that it's not San Diego is not necessarily transportable to the Oakland Hills or necessarily to the North Coast.
Good points. Well, I think as far as the board is concerned, we'll at least refer it to the Resource Protection Committee and let them do some work with it to see if it's something that they feel should come before the full board somewhere along the line. We'll move then to we do have two public speakers on this item.
The first speaker, Mr. Chairman and Mr. President, is Walt Mansell.
Thank you. I'm Walt Mansell. I'm not sure what hat I'm wearing right now. I normally appear before the Fish and Game Commission on behalf of the California Rifle and Pistol Association on matters dealing with wildlife and habitat and hunting and firearms issues. I also wear some other hats, and I don't know if all of you on the board remember this. I chair the RAC Committee in Tehama County. We have granted extensive funding to the Fire Safe Councils and to CDF for development of fire safe planning in Tehama County and some other things. We've developed or donated a lot of money directly to several different local communities for the assist in construction of fire fuel breaks around communities that are at risk. I myself live out in the middle of wild lands on a small ranch, and I work extensively every year, spend a lot of hours on tractors getting fire breaks around my house that I'm comfortable with that will defend my property. And I'm not without some experience here. I worked 11 years for CDF, nine of those years as a fire captain, part of that time as fire prevention patrolman. I ran a crew of CBs on the Bel Air Brentwood fire in Los Angeles in the early 1960s, which was the first catastrophic fire that burned 600 and some homes that today would have been rated $4 or $5 million apiece. So there are a lot of things about this. I agree with what Director Broderick said. To apply this everywhere without a study of everywhere kind of flies in the face of reality. I started my CDF career in San Diego County, and I'm familiar with, you know, in those days there were catastrophic fires size-wise that didn't burn the homes because the homes were not there. We could back off to the next ridge or the next ridge or the next ridge and eventually gain control of the fire, and we lost a lot of acres, but we didn't lose homes and communities, wholesale numbers. I think it's every landowner's responsibility to make his or her home as fire safe as it can. I remember the television aftermath of Bel Air Brentwood, talking to a famous movie star at the time, well, why didn't you clear around your house? Well, then I would have seen my neighbor's house. I didn't want to see my neighbor's house. I can tell you from first experience, I have family in Santa Barbara County, as Mr. Rogers has. When you go into Santa Barbara County and start talking about trimming or cutting trees, you are pushing a very, very, very strong political button. And Santa Barbara County does not have any direct CDF presence. They're a county fire department, a political animal of the county. So there's a lot of things, that pros and cons in this. What about state parks? Is this 100-foot clearance going to apply in state parklands around all structures? Have you considered that? I don't know. They've got some places they're really proud of with buildings out there. Thank you.
The next speaker is Jody Fradioni.
Thank you, SIPs, commissioners, board members. Just some general comments, and I could be wrong about this, but my understanding was that the amendments to 4291 were actually brought about as a result of concerns and actions or proposed actions by the insurance industry. So that they're actually driving a lot of this in my area in the Central Coast. I understand that some of the insurance companies are doing flyovers, and they're sending letters to homeowners, and this is before the Board of Forestry came up with its rule package, and they're basically saying, if you don't make changes, then we're dropping your policy. All that said, and I will just say that I'm not. That I've had my own experiences with fire. I've lived in a house burned to the ground. I've had tenants who burned a cabin to the ground. So I do understand the problems and the risks. It's not quite the same as catastrophic wildfire. But I will say that I'm a little concerned when I see something as expansive as this with the potential for statewide implementation that there are other issues. Right now, fire is, we've all got fire around the brain, but there are other issues as well. And just for instance, I have a neighbor who lives in a an area that has a lot of chaparrals, considered fire prone. Her neighborhood got a fire safe council going. They got videos. They learned all about this, and they did some clearing. She did the clearing around her house. The neighbor did clearing around her house. The next thing is we have rains. We have a lot of rain in Santa Cruz Mountains. And it was done, with root systems intact. But because you removed the canopy, the runoff and the sediment coming off of her neighbor's property came down, blocked up culvert, and the next thing, she had a flood in her garage. I know that with some of these things, with allowing for basically 100% clear cutting around homes, I shouldn't say homes, around structures. So it's not just homes. It could be all kinds of structures across one's property, but from tool sheds to garages to chicken sheds, et cetera, that you could have pretty extensive clearing and then have the potential for massive landslides, for exacerbated flooding. And I think that all those things need to be taken into account so we realize that fire is only one consideration. What's appropriate for San Diego may not be appropriate for other places in the state. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, that concludes those that have signed up to speak to this topic.
Well, from the board standpoint, I think a reference to our committee is appropriate, and the committee's recommendations back to the board will be defining for us. So. Nothing from the committee?
No.
Okay. Let's move then to item 7, which is a report of the departments regarding implementation of the joint policy on hardwoods. Eric Huff from the board staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, President, members of the board, and commissioners. Eric Huff, board staff. As many of you will recall, in the review of the joint hardwood policy last May, this joint assembly agreed that it was time to do a little outreach to local governments dealing with hardwood issues. To that end, the board and commission approved of a joint letter, which was later posted in December of 05 to 41 different California counties, The letter reinforced state support mechanisms available to local jurisdictions, whether it was the Integrated Hardwood Range Management Program and the outreach that they do, the Oak Woodland Conservation Program, the Fire and Resource Assessment Program, and several others. And in the interest of continuing a dialogue with these local jurisdictions, the letter also requested that counties provide the board and commissioners with copies of Oak Woodland Conservation Plans and any local hardwood-related resolutions. To date, I can report that four counties have responded by providing materials from Oak Woodland Conservation Plans to resolutions. Those counties are Tehama, Madera, Monterey, and Santa Cruz. There may be others, perhaps, I've missed, but my records indicate four counties have responded. So the next step is to do some more outreach through personal phone calls if need be, but to try and establish a dialogue with those counties that haven't responded and to maintain the dialogue with those that have, of course. And that is all I have to report at present.
Okay.
Questions?
Board members have questions? Thanks for the update.
Thank you.
Eric, appreciate it. Item 9, federal agencies. I know Charlotte Ambrose has some comments. Are there any other federal agencies here this afternoon that want to speak?
Good afternoon. I agree we all need to get outside as quickly as possible, so I will keep my comments short. Actually, I had not intended on speaking, but I do want to follow up on some of Ryan's comments from before. My name is Charlotte Ambrose. I am the National Marine Fisheries Service Recovery Coordinator for the North Central California Coast Recovery Domain. What does that mean? Essentially, my job is to facilitate the development of recovery plans for federally listed anadromous salmonids in California. There are four of us. My particular domain has four species: Northern California steelhead, California Coast Chinook, Central California Coast coho salmon, and Central California Coast steelhead. So as you might imagine, and as Fish and Game knows, it's a bit of herding cats. But I appreciate the work that Fish and Game has done relative to starting that task, and look forward to working with Fish and Game relative to the development of recovery plans for those species in my domain, starting with Central California Coast coho. First and foremost, I want to preface by saying I'm not here to answer any questions relative to the Klamath. Rod will be joining you on Thursday, and he will be able to do that for you. I would also like to build on what Banky mentioned earlier and his enthusiasm. I share his enthusiasm. I also believe that we are very close to finding some resolutions relative to acknowledging forest practices and other land management strategies across the state, whether it's a 4D rule, whether it's an HCP, whether it's Section 6. I think we need to keep all of those options open, and our agency is committed to working with them enthusiastically to see what we can do. And I think we're much further up that hill that Ryan spoke of, especially since the commission has adopted the State Coho Recovery Plan. The TNI review underway, the 2112 development underway, of course, the State Coho Recovery Plan that we have in place, and I want to compliment Fish and Game for their hard work. We continue to work on that committee and look forward to moving forward. The joint policy that's in place between the Commission and the Board of Forestry, the voluntary efforts that are underway, and all of those things combined move us closer to reaching our goals relative to 4D and finding a workable solution for all of us. Assistant Regional Administrator Russ Strock set some very aggressive timelines for recovery plan development for the recovery coordinators, and we are scheduled to finalize recovery plans for all listed anadromous salmonids, all federally listed anadromous salmonids, by December of 2007. So with four species in my domain, that presents quite a challenge, but I certainly welcome the challenge. My domain right now is working first to develop a recovery plan for a draft recovery plan for Central California Coast coho. We will build from the state plan. We are working with Fish and Game, And many times people say, well, why didn't you just adopt the state coho recovery plan? Well, unfortunately, the statutory differences between CESA and FISA make it essentially impossible for us to do so. But we have published a Federal Register notice announcing our intent to prepare a recovery plan for coho, Central California Coast coho, and we will build from the state coho plan as much as we possibly can and work with our partners with Fish and Game. The first step that's taking place relative to Central California Coast coho is the development of analysis of threats. We have acquired money from Sonoma County Water Agency, and we have hired Stillwater Sciences and the Nature Conservancy to help us evaluate threats relative to Central California Coast coho, and we are in the process of setting the stage for conducting expert workshops as well as public workshops. You should expect to see public workshops not only in out of my domain, but also the Central Valley, June 13th and June 15th. And that's to set the stage for the development of the plans and get input by not only our stakeholders but our partners, as well as some of those casual landowners that we that are really important to this process. Let's see here. So we have federal recovery planning in place, and we look forward to working with you in the future. And stay tuned. There's more to come. Any questions?
Richard?
Yeah, just one quick one. I guess I didn't realize that North Coast steelhead and Central Coast steelhead are two different species.
They are.
What makes them different?
Reproductively isolated.
Oh. Genetically the same, but reproductively isolated?
Genetically reproductively isolated. So the evolutionarily significant unit means that there is enough reproductive isolation between units that you would not expect them to interbreed.
Sort of like Alaska otters.
I wouldn't know about Alaska otters.
You're a Fed.
Sorry. Thank you.
Thanks, Charlotte. We have, under public forum, we have two speakers requesting time, and then we're pretty much through for the day. Whoops. Oh.
Shall you call his name just so we can have it on the record?
The first speaker for public forum will be Walt Mansell.
Thank you. I am at this time representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association wholeheartedly. Just to update the commission, who I gave a heads up on this last month, and will be new news to the Board of Forestry, but a couple of weeks ago on Wednesday, on the campus of USC in Los Angeles, representatives of my organization and of Ducks Unlimited participated in the annual Environmental Earth Day celebration on the campus. Was the first time since they've been celebrating Earth Day down there that any pro-hunting, pro-wildlife organizations were invited to attend. We were welcomed. I found out that I think the hunting and firearms owners are live and well on the campuses. Maybe they're keeping their heads down, but we had many good comments and very few poor comments. We went there not knowing really what to expect. At the CRPA table, we handed out literature provided by the NRA, the California Rifle and Pistol Association, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, and a whole lot provided by the California Department of Fish and Game. And we want to thank Cassie and the Hunter Education section at Wildlife Protection Headquarters for the package of things that she gave us. I have some things here that I'll give to John, and he can pass out. There's enough copies for everybody up there and quite a few for the audience here also of two of the handouts that we gave, and I realize you go home from here every meeting with a giant New York phone book of material to read, but the simple little thing we invented, the 10 points to ponder, I would like you, if you just take a minute to talk about those. It's Hunters, Wildlife, and the Environment, 10 points to ponder, and we just listed 10 points. We don't make judgments too much, but we just list the 10 points to get people thinking about the role of hunters in the environment and some of the other things that are really bigger issues should be. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next speaker will be Richard Ginger.
Richard Ginger, Board, Commission, President, and Chairman. This is an informational item for you, a heads up. Maybe next month there'll be a formal petition for rules based upon this draft. This draft for project proponent monitoring tracking is going to be discussed and agendized at the monitoring study group on May 23rd, what I understand. It fits in with a number of different purposes. One of which is in the Coho Recovery Timberland Recommendations to have a, specifically for Coho, to work out a process whereby a determination of the effectiveness of the measures to protect Coho are evaluated before CDF comes out for their completion report. Another big purpose, I believe, of this requiring some standards for project proponents to do this is that there's a big surge of interest in so-called performance standards, and that I feel that self-evaluation of a good quality is really important to actually achieving performance standards. I know that all different staff related to your board and commission wring their hands often about the lack of monitoring, and I think that this would go a long ways toward both supporting good stewardship and making corrections as necessary. The idea generally is that the monitoring procedures would be determined during plan review. They would be of a reasonable yet effective nature. And I would point out to you one of the under-implemented, I think it's an exaggeration, is 916.11, effectiveness and implementation monitoring, which is a part of the threatener impaired rules, which I think is more broadly applicable, where it gives CDF the authority to require such monitoring. And I think that having reasonable monitoring should be more broadly in effect and used. So I would encourage your checking it out. It's pretty simple. There probably will be another draft iteration, trying to get as much input from all involved to have the best package possible when it's presented to the board as a formal package. Thank you.
The final speaker is Paul Rackland. Weakland. Excuse me. Going once, going twice. Gone.
Meeting is adjourned.
That was quick.